You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
I'm currently on a book tour around the United States and hope to see you. Find the schedule of my events at warisalie.org. It is my privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Peter Enns. He is associate professor in the Department of Government at Cornell University and executive director of the Roper Center for Public Opinion Research. He is also team leader of the Cornell Institute for Social Science theme project on the causes, consequences, and future of mass incarceration. And he is a former faculty director of Cornell's Prison Education Program. His research has been funded by the National Science Foundation and the Russell Sage Foundation, and has appeared in journals such as the American Journal of Political Science, British Journal of Political Science, Journal of Politics, Perspectives on Politics, and Public Opinion Quarterly. He edited with Christopher Lezine, Who Gets Represented? And he is the author of the book that is the topic of this week's program, Incarceration Nation: How the United States Became the Most Punitive Democracy in the World. Peter Enns, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you very much, David. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, and thank you for writing this book. Tell us your basic thesis. What caused mass incarceration over the past number of decades in the United States?
What I'm trying to draw attention to with this book is the important role of public opinion, and specifically the public's punitiveness, and how that's shifted over time. And when we think of the U.S. legal system, the criminal justice system, we often think or maybe have the ideal that it would be insulated or protected from the public's preferences. But when we look at the data and the record, public opinion and rising punitiveness through the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s has been a driving factor in the rise of mass incarceration in this country.
Driving factor, so one factor among many, or really the decisive factor in creating this situation?
My research shows the decisive factor. Now, politics, the political world, the criminal justice system, these are complex issues. So there's always going to be multiple things going on, and different forces can influence each other in different ways, and we could see back and forth type effects. But over and over again, we know that political decisions, for example, how crime is punished, sentencing rates, mandatory minimum sentences, these were political choices that were made and at both the state and the federal level. But what we have to keep in mind is the reason for these, that the political decisions moved in a punitive direction, was that our political leaders and the criminal justice system were following an increasingly punitive public and a growing public demand for being tough on crime.
And the public opinion was following, in your understanding, media coverage, and media coverage was following reality in terms of increased crime rates? I mean, it sounds like a perfectly functioning democracy almost.
Yeah, well, in with a few important caveats. And so one aspect of this democratic component of the system representing changing public opinion is it really raises the question of what is the role of public opinion. And we ended up with the highest incarceration rate in the world. So that's an important thing to reflect upon. The other thing is your characterization is exactly right. When the crime rate began going up in the 60s and it continued through the 70s and 80s and early 90s, media covered crime more. So there is this link with media covering crime more, and then crime's been going down since the 90s and media's covered crime less. So this overtime connection is exactly as we would expect. But the important caveat is media tends to portray crime in a very specific way. So we get over-reporting on violent crime, and so the public tends to think there's much more violent crime committed than there is. crimes that are committed by racial minorities tend to be over-reported by media, both in newspaper and television. And then, of course, there's the common saying, if it bleeds, it leads. And that there's an element of truth to that saying, and what that refers to is how, again, the types of crimes being covered and how media are covering the crime. So just because the media covers crime more when the crime rate increases, and that translates into a more punitive public, it doesn't always have to be that way. Media could choose to cover crime in different ways.
So if U.S. television news broadcasts had covered crime during the 60s, 70s, 80s, and had covered crime in relationship to gun proliferation, in relationship to slashed budgets for schools, in relationship to poverty and other factors contributing to crime, the results might have been significantly different from the sort of context-free, scary focus on the latest violent crimes by non-white Americans.
That's absolutely correct, because if these news stories were bringing up these points you mentioned and thinking of the causes of crime, of why crime rates increasing, what policies are going to be the most cost effective in terms of addressing crime and reducing crime, we might expect a very different public response. But if it's focusing on the nature of crime and over-reporting on violent crime, this is what leads to that natural public response of a demand for being tougher on crime, which turns out to be having the highest incarceration rate in the world, as the U.S. now does. That's incredibly expensive. And so most researchers, most economists now are in agreement that it actually, this is not even close to the most cost-effective way to try to reduce crime.
In your book, you cite also possible public response to not just crime coverage on news shows, but criminal dramas out of Hollywood on television. I mean, surely that is not a simple reporting on reality, but a very selective fictionalization of what's going on, and that's influencing public opinion on political solutions.
Absolutely. This was something I was very interested in because as I was trying to understand why the public became more punitive, this is also a period where these television shows, crime dramas, are becoming increasingly popular. And so what I was able to do was get data from the Nielsen Corporation, who tracks how many people are viewing each shows, and I was able to find how much of the viewing population was watching these crime dramas over time. And what's interesting is in the early period of rising public punitiveness, we actually see a decline in the viewership of these types of crime dramas, moving in opposite direction. And this is partly because of the short-lived family viewership hour, where there was an attempt to put different, more family-friendly programming in primetime viewing hours. So what this shows is the punitiveness appears to be following the news and the news coverage of the crime rate. But so the driving factor was not the proliferation of these crime shows. But that doesn't mean there's zero effect. And in fact, there's some evidence of this reinforcing effect. As the public became more punitive, we saw more of these shows, but that might have had this reinforcing effect further contributing to public punitiveness.
Now, what you try to argue, Peter Enns, in your book against a common belief is that when public opinion developed in favor of more punitive incarceration policies, politicians followed that as representatives in a government should, rather than the politicians imposing that idea on the public with their demagoguery. Is that right? And how can you, how do you substantiate that claim in your book?
Sure. The standard view is we think back to prominent politicians. So often Barry Goldwater comes to mind, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, as taking these tough on crime positions. And the standard view is the public was hearing the politicians speak, and the public then reacted to what the political leaders were saying. But as I looked into the history, that's not what the evidence shows. And I'll give you one example. I looked at through President Richard Nixon's library with the archival materials that are available. I could access internal campaign memos from his 1968 campaign. And what was going on was, even before the nominating convention, they were looking at national polls being conducted by the main survey organizations of the day. They were also conducting their own polls, and they found that public concern with crime was consistently at the top of the list. The public was responding that they were concerned with crime. They thought that the court and the system were too lenient. And so in these memos, they keep referring back to these public opinion polls, and they're crafting a campaign strategy. And if we think back to 1960 with Nixon's unsuccessful presidential campaign, he didn't emphasize crime. Domestic crime never came up in his campaign. So if we want to if we think of Nixon as leading the public, we might have thought in both 60 and 68, crime would have been a top issue, but it wasn't. The change to focusing on crime, based on these internal memos that I was able to access, indicate they were actually noticing public concern with the issue and building that into the campaign strategy.
What makes the United States so radically different from the rest of the world? If its incarceration rate 50 years ago, 60 years ago, was not so out of the mainstream on Earth, and now it is, I mean, was it a difference in the character of our public, or in crime rates that developed for certain reasons, or in the media and Hollywood, or in how our politicians operate? What has made this difference?
All of those factors you mentioned definitely play a part. One thing I'll add, and this relates to the nature of the political system, as you mentioned. In the U.S., we have a two-party system. There's sometimes exceptions, but it's typically the Republican or the Democratic Party. And in other countries that have proportional representation systems, other democracies, this leads to multi-party systems. So what happens with the issue of crime and punishment in the U.S. with a two-party system, the Republican Party was more in tune to the public's increasing punitiveness early on. And so, but then the Democratic Party noticed this, and they aligned themselves also with the rising public punitiveness. And so we see this with President Lyndon Johnson in his landslide election victory in 64. In the months after his election to the White House, his public approval ratings are through the roof. He's incredibly popular, but he starts to shift speech after speech in a more and more punitive direction. Instead of emphasizing addressing the roots of crime, he starts addressing the need to put more police on the streets, the need to do more to address, to support the criminal justice system in an immediate way. And so crime is an issue where if the public's becoming more punitive, even if the most cost-effective approach is investing in schools, communities, job training, mental health policies, those take longer. And politicians can say, point to how much more they put in the budget, how many more police they put on the street, how many more individuals were arrested and locked up. Those immediate numbers, once one party went in that direction of a short-term strategy, the other party had that incentive, and that just fed off each other and kept us going for decades of rising an increasingly punitive system and rising incarceration rate.
And the difference in other countries without the two-party system and with a different system of communications that has allowed them to address poverty and other causes of crime rather than simply packing more prisons full of people? How has the difference worked in those other places?
Well, in some cases, countries have spent more on their social safety networks, and so there's that element. In the what I think often happens in a system like many European democracies that have multiple prominent parties, those parties can stick to their issues and they're known for more narrow issues. So they stick to their issues year after year, election after election. And in the U.S. context, you know, it's very interesting. We're in a very politically polarized environment where Democrats and Republicans tend to be very far apart, the political parties, on most issues. But when they align in the same direction, and they didn't always want the exact same policies, there are very meaningful differences, even on crime and punishment, among Democrats and Republicans. But when they both shift in a more punitive direction together, that pushes policy along faster than we would in a system where there are multiple parties, each advocating for their more specific sets of issues, trying to come to agreement.
It seems like you're telling a story, though, for all its flaws, of really representative government in the United States some decades gone by now. And I wonder if you find that was true in those years for other issues beyond punitiveness and mass incarceration, because today and in recent decades, it certainly on many, many issues does not look like the U.S. government responds to public opinion in any consistent way. There have been studies looking at, you know, where public opinion is on polls on many issues and where the government is, and finding no overlap. I mean, scholarly studies concluding that the U.S. government is an oligarchy. You know, is this something that has worsened so that the government was properly responding to the public demand for mass incarceration and now is going to fail to properly respond to a public demand to undo mass incarceration through, you know, the factors of funding from private incarceration companies and all these other forms of corruption? Or is this issue... is this issue different? I mean, was our government not very responsive on other issues even 50 years ago?
That's a great question that raises a lot of important things we need to think about. So one is this idea, has the political system changed? Are we less representative? And probably the biggest shift in the political system in the United States is the importance and the amount of fundraising that politicians need to do. So they're increasingly dependent on more and more money for their campaign. So this is a big change in U.S. politics. At the same time, the public's been moving in a less punitive direction, and we see prominent members of both political parties, both on the Democratic side and Republican side, calling for the need for criminal justice reform. So it appears that even in this day and age, the politicians are noticing shifting public opinions and responding. And when I say shifting public opinions, that's really important because what I'm showing is that when public opinion moves in a certain way as punitive, some responds in that same direction. Oftentimes, policymakers, politicians are doing what we want. It's the very specific details. And so a mandatory minimum sentence of 20 years. When the public becomes more punitive, most members of the public, they don't have specific sentence length in mind. They don't have specific classifications for what should be a felony and what shouldn't, what constitutes an amount of drugs that is possession versus intent to sell. So these details, those often don't align with what the public's ideal view is, because the public often doesn't have that level of specificity. We leave that to the policymakers. But when public opinion moves in a certain direction, the system tends to respond. But when we're talking about the implications for representation, there's been the consequences of the justice system and mass incarceration, even if it was following the public. By many counts, it's hard to think of this as actually representing the public, because the negative implications are massive in terms of the cost of maintaining the world's highest incarceration rate, but also the implications for those incarcerated, their families, their communities are overwhelming, and it's not been distributed equally in the sense that those of disadvantaged socioeconomic backgrounds are much more likely to be arrested and imprisoned. Racial minorities are much more likely to be arrested and imprisoned. And so do, although it, on the one hand, feels democratic, public opinion changed and the system responded, when we focus on the outcomes and the consequences and the cost, from that perspective, it doesn't feel democratic at all.
In fact, you cite in your introduction, in your book, studies suggesting that mass incarceration can actually increase criminality rather than decreasing it. Given that possibility, is it the case that the public wants to punish somebody, whether they're guilty or not, so badly with such irrational rage that they just don't care if it produces more crime? Or is it the case that the politicians, who perhaps know a little bit more what's going on, have that disregard for human welfare, or that everybody just doesn't know?
I think what's happened is when crime was going up, and we talked about this focus on violent in the crime and punishment is an incredibly complex issue, and it's really hard to know what the best policy is going to be. And so I think the public punitiveness focused on the narrow, focused on the need to do something, the need to crack down, the need to punish, and kind of like you described. And it was, I don't think a disregard for others, but I think it was a very narrow, specific focus, and media coverage of crime wasn't encouraging the public or politicians to think or talk about this in a broader context. We're seeing a little bit of change in that now with increased attention within the media to racial disparities within the criminal justice system. We also see media coverage of injustices or errors in the criminal justice system, and coverage of sometimes individuals who have been on death row and have then been released, exonerated because they were found to be innocent. And so when, as the crime rate's gone down and media coverage has begun to present the information in a little more nuanced way, the public opinion can be quite smart, and it, members of the public care about these issues, and when they're given the relevant information, the appropriate context can be brought to bear. And so hopefully we're in an environment where the discussion can be more information-based and have the appropriate nuances instead of just a demand for punishment and ignoring the consequences.
You know, during about the same years that you look at this growth in punitiveness in the U.S. public, the U.S. government has been marketing its overseas wars as punishment of international wrongdoers, and has normalized warfare to the point where a presidential candidate was asked some months back in a debate on television, are you willing to kill thousands of innocent children as part of your basic responsibilities as commander-in-chief, to the point where our current president has bragged about the seven nations he's bombed, and I can find hardly anyone who can even name them. It's become this sort of accepted, punitive, counterproductive, war on terrorism that increases terrorism, and we don't care, we'll just do more of it. Have you ever looked at connections between this punitive attitude domestically and U.S. foreign affairs, where in war making the United States is as different from the rest of the world as it is in incarceration?
That's a really interesting point, and I haven't looked at the overtime public attitudes toward war in this way, but I think the connections you're making make sense, because it really relates to when media covers a issue in a very similar way, in a very focused way, it tends to drive and have a very strong influence for public opinion. When we get if media covers, so again, an issue like how to decreasingly complicated international relations and how to best protect a society from potential foreign or external threats, or in a world where terrorism is increasingly on the minds of people, these are complex issues that require complex debate. And if we just get punchlines, headlines, that's going to lead to different public reactions and probably different political reactions than if we get more context, more discussion, and more research and investigation.
We have just a few minutes left. Thinking about the two-party system and the possibility of our government actually representing us on this issue, and the increasing power of the presidency and obsession of the public with the presidency, you have a candidate in Donald Trump who, to all appearances, wants to increase mass incarceration. You have a candidate in Hillary Clinton who talks about opposing over mass incarceration as if she wants just the right level of mass incarceration, and both of them widely despised by the U.S. public. I mean, their negative ratings through the roof. How can, if one of these individuals drives the agenda going forward, how will that represent U.S. opinion shifting against mass incarceration?
Sure. The current political environment with the presidential election, very, very important, and of course important for the future of this country politically. So I think one important point to remember and recognize is how much Hillary Clinton as a candidate has shifted her view from in 1994 when the crime bill, when she supported the 1994 crime bill and it was signed by President Bill Clinton. So that shift, although she still isn't calling for an end for radical change, she's shifted dramatically, and that's consistent with the declining public punitiveness I've mentioned during this time period. So a big factor is how is the public's views toward crime and punishment going to continue in the future years? Will they continue to become less punitive? If the crime rate drops, we can expect that. If the crime rate goes up, it's going to depend how media covers crime. And you mentioned Trump as a candidate, and Trump is really hard to understand. That's partly, I'm a political scientist, and political scientists have really struggled, as I think media and a lot, to understand. Nobody predicted Trump would have this much success. But we're still in the primary. If Trump becomes the nominee, it would be it's highly possible that if he's attempting to win the general election, he will look also to the shifting public attitude, and he will change his statements more to be more in line with the overall public as opposed to the primary voters who he's currently catering.
Well, I suspect it's going to take more than just the right answers in polls. It's going to take a massive popular movement to move some of these people, if we can do it. But I think this book gives us a wonderful idea of how we got here, and I highly recommend it. It's called Incarceration Nation: How the United States Became the Most Punitive Democracy in the World, by Peter Enns. Peter, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you. My pleasure.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. I'm traveling around the United States right now doing events with my new book, War is a Lie, second edition. I hope to see you. Find the schedule of events at warisalie.org. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, despite the impact it would have on millions of people and the planet, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP, like all such agreements, was being negotiated in secret. That is, until Greenpeace Netherlands released classified documents revealing elements of the deal the EU and the US were moving merrily toward. Now, some say the pact may be scuttled. What is in those documents? We'll hear from Karen Hansen-Kuhn of the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. Also on the show, what was called possibly the biggest gang raid in New York history, with involvement by Homeland Security, the FBI, and the BATF, drove similarly sweeping media coverage. A Daily News headline was typical, describing those arrested as Bronx gang members responsible for 9 years of murders and drug dealing. No allegedly, no police say, and no time really to hear from the community that was set upon in the pre-dawn by agents in military gear with helicopters overhead. Josmar Trujillo is a writer and organizer. He addresses the idea of police raids as a response to violence and why corporate media are so drawn to it. We'll hear from him on that. All of that's coming up, and there's a lot of it, so we'll take a very brief look back at recent press. The Washington Post's Dana Milbank said he would eat the page on which his column was printed if Donald Trump gained the Republican nomination. The entire commentariat is going to feel a little silly when Marco Rubio wins every Republican primary, tweeted the New York Times' Ross Douthat. Trump will still lose. Here's how, said Bloomberg News. No, Donald Trump won't win, lectured David Brooks, and on and on. These experts, it would seem, were wrong, and confidently, arrogantly, condescendingly so. But as Zaid Jilani and Glenn Greenwald, who corralled some examples for The Intercept, note, they will pay absolutely no price for it, and that's a problem. It isn't that journalists should never make predictions or that they're expected to always be right, but you do have to wonder why so much energy is devoted to the endeavor, given that nothing seems to be learned when pundits are off base. At the very least, write Greenwald and Jilani, when a profession that touts its expertise collectively is this wildly wrong about something so significant, more needs to be done than a cursory, superficial acknowledgement of error or casting blame on others before quickly moving on in the hope that it's all forgotten. Well, economist Dean Baker held up the New York Times' Thomas Friedman's May 3rd column as emblematic of this sort of establishment thinking that, as they say, might be wrong but is never in doubt. The piece has a hefty admixture of Friedman speak. On the eve of Obama's presidency, a lot of things started to get very fast all at once, he says. So that was the time to double down on our formula for success. And then there's something about sowing seeds for the next generation of startups. But in among that is a familiar complaint about how the two parties need to compromise, like the grand bargain on the budget that Obama tried to negotiate in 2011 with then-Speaker John Boehner. Friedman blames GOP stubbornness and says that Donald Trump is where this sort of extremism leads. He hopes that now everyone will move to the center and work out the deals that he'd like to see, and maybe more important, that all the know-nothings would be chased out of political debate. Speaking of the 2008 economic collapse, Friedman writes, quote, "In this vortex, a lot of the public got unmoored and disoriented, opening the way for populists with simple answers. Get rid of immigrants, end trade with China, or eliminate big banks, and all will be fine. It's nonsense." Close quote. It is nonsense. It's also not what anybody is saying. Even Trump's nutty, inhumane plan isn't to get rid of all immigrants. No one suggests ending trade with China, and while Sanders agrees with many leading economists that breaking up too-big-to-fail banks is important, none of them say that will make everything fine. Those are made-up positions that Friedman attributes to people he doesn't like as a reason to demand that all serious talk be left to serious people, like himself. Of course, those were some of the same serious people who said Donald Trump would never be the Republican nominee. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Corporate media talk about trade pacts, which have little to do at this point with actual trade, but the coverage is generally pretty thin and vague, perhaps in part because for corporate media, corporate globalization is simply inevitable. If the horse trading of livelihoods and lives for markets is unseemly, well, let's not try to take too close a look. The leak of a draft of the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP, by Greenpeace Netherlands may have thrown a wrench in that deal's inevitability, though media's interpretation of the document's meaning will play a role there. So what's in and what's not in the TTIP, according to these revelations? We're joined now by Karen Hansen-Kuhn, Director of Trade, Technology, and Global Governance at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. She joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Counterspin, Karen Hansen-Kuhn.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Well, I think Americans can be forgiven for not being up on another massive deal that will affect our lives, especially when pains are being taken to keep us from knowing about it, really. So what do we learn from these documents that Greenpeace Netherlands received from an unknown source and have now released?
Well, it was a big release. They released something like 200 pages of what's called consolidated text. So that shows both the U.S. position, the EU position, and areas where they've agreed on a number of chapters. It doesn't include everything, but it includes a lot of the issues that we're looking at. And what's significant about the leak, in part, is, I mean, this sounds crazy, but this is the first time we actually know what the U.S. wants out of this deal. There's been a steady flow of leaks from the European Union. They have actually published a lot of their position papers, and the U.S. has not. So a lot of the analysis we've been doing up to now has been based on what Europe said they want out of this agreement, and for the first time we're getting more evidence of what the U.S. is pushing for.
And what is the U.S. pushing for?
Well, it's funny. One of the issues we've been focusing on is around agricultural exports to Europe. You know, as you said in the intro, tariffs are already pretty low. A lot of this isn't really even about trade. It's about rules. It's about changing regulations on both sides of the Atlantic so corporations can buy and sell wherever they want. And so one of the big agenda items for the U.S. is to be able to export GMOs and other biotechnology products to Europe. There's also a big push to allow for beef produced with hormones, chicken rinsed in chlorine, practices that aren't allowed in Europe. In the chapter on food safety, what they call sanitary and phytosanitary standards, there is information about speeding up, or proposals about speeding up the approval process in Europe, about using science that is the same language they've used in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, science that is, in many cases, data provided by industry to justify new rules. So we have the U.S. asking Europe to give up a lot on their food safety standards, their agricultural standards. Europe is asking the U.S. to give up a lot on public procurement. So that's different kinds of projects that are contracted out, publicly funded programs like farm-to-school programs, highway construction. Europe would like their companies to be able to bid on any of those contracts with no buy local provisions, no minority or small business set-asides. Also, Europe wants to free up exports of liquefied natural gas, which could mean more fracking in the U.S. But I do want to say I think it would be a mistake to think that that's the whole story. Both sides are pushing really hard for new protections for investment. There's been a lot of discussion lately about this investor-state dispute settlement provision.
Right.
So that allows companies to sue governments over rules that affect their profits. So we have TransCanada suing the U.S. over the Keystone Pipeline decision, for example. Both sides want to get that kind of provision in the trade agreement, which could mean a lot more lawsuits like that. Both sides want to include something we haven't seen before much in trade agreements, what's called regulatory cooperation. So basically establishing a lot of new roadblocks to new rules. Any kind of new rule on, say, food safety or toxic chemicals or what have you would have to go through this whole obstacle course of different cost-benefit analyses and different things that would slow down new rules. So really, you know, while there are particular interests that the U.S. has versus what Europe has, overall this is a corporate agenda, and that's really what's driving the process.
Well, let me just ask you simply, how is this not trading away sovereignty? I have heard the ISDS, that investor state dispute settlement, I've heard that kind of laughed off. I've heard pundits say, oh no, you know, we can still make domestic rules about pollution, for example. Other countries won't be able to overturn our laws. Well, other countries maybe not, but transnational corporations, it sounds like, would, or at least would have standing to do that. Is that not a threat to sovereignty?
Oh, it's absolutely a threat. And, you know, we haven't been hearing as much in the United States about TTIP, the transatlantic deal, in part because there's been so much focus on the TPP. But this is headline news in Europe. There have been massive demonstrations, particularly in Germany, Austria, and France. And a lot of it does focus on this investor state provision. And in Germany, a lot of it was sparked by Germany decided to phase out nuclear power. And so a Swedish firm is suing them for $5 billion. So that is absolutely a threat to their sovereignty, and it's something that has had hundreds of thousands of people out on the streets. Just this week, the president of France said, you know, if this is what the agreement is, we can't sign on to this. And the lead negotiator said maybe the talks would be suspended. So it has been big news in Europe. I think we need more of a focus in the U.S. too, but certainly it's absolutely a threat to sovereignty.
How can it, though, be a surprise to global leaders? Are they not aware that this is what these trade deals do? I mean, I don't think it's really a shock. The details, of course, are horrifying in their specifics, but the general thrust of it is not a shock to activists who've been doing this work for years. Why are national leaders, is it a pretense that they are surprised by it? I'm not quite clear what's going on with that.
Well, I would say there's two pieces to that. First of all, they are reacting because there is such a massive public outcry. So they're reacting to what their populations are concerned about. On the other hand, I think since the beginning of these talks, Europe has said, I mean, I've talked to agriculture ministers, for example, in Europe, and they say really consistently, no hormone beef, no chlorine chicken, no GMOs. And they'll say this in public statements, and then 2 weeks later, someone from the U.S. government would say, this is absolutely on the agenda. So it's going back and forth. You know, we are in the process of negotiations, and while a lot of what's in the text is shocking, it's still under negotiation. I don't think they're surprised. I mean, these issues have been on the table since the beginning. I suspect what is a surprise is just the degree of public reaction in Europe.
Well, let's continue with that, because it's somewhat irritating in a way to hear the New York Times say on May 2nd, after decades of free trade orthodoxy, there's been growing resistance to further liberalizing the movement of goods, services, capital, and labor. It sounds as though activism has sprung out of nowhere on this issue, when in fact, even in the United States, we've had decades of work, have we not, of understanding what these corporate-centric trade pacts do and of resisting them.
Oh, absolutely. When this big leak came out, it made me think back to the free trade area of the Americas. Those texts were published. That was going to be a massive free trade agreement in all of the Americas, North and South America. And it was defeated because of activism throughout the hemisphere. Certainly, there have been big fights on each of the trade agreements, and just last summer, the approval process for fast tracks, the process that Congress uses to debate these trade agreements, was hugely controversial. So I think there's more public opposition. We see it more than perhaps in the last few years, but absolutely, this has been going on for a long time.
Say we hear that the pact actually has been scuttled. Is that the end of the story?
No, certainly not. I mean, of course, there is the other big trade agreement on the horizon, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which could be coming up for a vote sometime this year or perhaps next year. So there's absolutely that. But even if we were to defeat both of them, there are still these issues of corporate control over our food systems, over our economies, and we need to keep pushing for alternatives.
We've been speaking with Karen Hansen-Kuhn of the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. You can find their work online at iatp.org. Karen Hansen-Kuhn, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
New York tabloids didn't bother with terms like alleged in their stories on the early morning raid in the Bronx, in which law enforcement, local and federal, arrested more than 100 people accused of gang membership. There was no need to observe such niceties in a tale of violent thugs being taken down. The New York Times did use the word accused, but their depiction of the community involved was no less cartoonish. For the last 10 years, the Times told readers, quote, life in the northern Bronx has been largely defined by wanton violence, close quote. One wonders how much the Times knows about what defines life in the northern Bronx and why they and other media are so ready to cheer uncritically for this style of militarized intervention, ostensibly aimed at reducing violence. Josmar Trujillo is a writer and organizer with New Yorkers Against Bratton. His work appears in City Limits, Huffington Post, and other outlets. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Josmar Trujillo.
Hey, Janine. How are you?
Well, first give us a little context. I mean, even though you wouldn't guess it from media, I think some listeners probably have heard that crime is actually declining. So what is your sense of what drove this really outsized show of force? I mean, 700 agents. What's behind that?
Raids, and gang raids in particular, aren't new in New York City or really in the United States. But last Wednesday's raid, the size of it and the media hype around it, they're expanding from the last, I'd say, like 2 to 3 years. And probably even more so since the death of a police officer in my neighborhood in Spanish Harlem last October. A lot of that had to do with the strategy of the district attorney there, Cy Vance. Now, Cy Vance's father was the former Secretary of Defense under Jimmy Carter. Cy Vance has these really ambitious political aspirations. And so when he came in, I think he wanted to peg himself as like a gangbuster. If you look around in the city today, we have probably the slowest crime stats in the city's history for like the last 50 years. There's no Lucchese crime family. You know, there's no big-name mobsters or gangsters out there. So how can you become a gangbuster? You find gang members, or maybe in some cases create or hype up what are known as crews, which are these local groupings of young men in public housing that a lot of law enforcement equate to gangs. So Vance in 2014 launched this huge raid in West Harlem where 103 people were indicted, and that had set the city's record up until last Wednesday. Another part of that might have been the arrival of Bill Bratton. He not only has a lot of experience going after gangs in Los Angeles when he was the LAPD chief, but he's also really good at squeezing out as much mileage out of the media in terms of law enforcement. He's kind of renowned for being like a media master,
right,
as much as a police mind. So my best sense is the raids in East Chester Gardens last week, which, again, is, first of all, in the context of a city that is like much, much safer. But even that particular neighborhood, when you look at CompStat reports, again, the police department's own reports, has crime stats for like maybe the last 6, 7, 8 years. Every single year, more safe than the last. And in shootings and murders in particular, which is what the media was hyping up, the last CompStat report we saw was there was 2 shootings year-to-date so far in 2016. So again, not zero, but definitely much lower than highs of New York City at its peak had, a couple of thousand murders a year. My best sense is that the raid itself last week, which included several federal agencies, it's one of the reasons is federal charges are being used against these suspects. So these guys are no longer being tried in state courts. They're being tried in federal courts. But part of that is also just normalizing the role of federal authorities to deal with is basically street crimes, violent street crimes, but still street crimes. And my best sense is the federal agencies are trying to just find a place in crime because there's really not a lot of use for them in a lot of other areas.
Everybody wants a slice.
Everybody come on into the party while it's getting hot because the police department is making it a point. And in December, and with the help of the Daily News, they basically announced that they were going to be doing this and this is going to be the new normal. And part of that is using the media, like the Daily News, to create this idea that there's a gang on every street corner of New York City.
They also had that useful to the reader guide about your own relationship to gangs, right?
Yeah, I think the quote was, how close are they to you? And they had like this interactive map where you could basically, you know, very conveniently, you could, you know, plug in your street address and find out, oh, look, honey, there's a gang nearby.
I know listeners understand that we're not saying that none of the people arrested is guilty of anything. You know, that's a straw man argument we can dispense with. But the New York Times in their story had basically a single community source that wasn't an authority. And that was a woman who said, I'm so glad I would kiss the captain's feet, you know, talking about the raid. Well, you also talked to people in Eastchester Gardens in the wake of this most recent raid. What were some of the thoughts that people were telling you that didn't make it into that Times story?
So the very first person that we spoke to, and we went on there on Wednesday, you know, early evening, 10, 12 hours after the raid, and the first person that we spoke to, she was like, I don't know what they're talking about. I'm out here with Mike. She was out there with her two kids and her dog. She was like, I'm out here every night with my kids. I feel pretty safe. I've been living here since I was born. She was 37, so she's been there 37 years. I don't know what they're talking about. If there was any violence, it was probably like 10 years ago, and it's much safer now. She said, as you can see, I'm out here at night with my kids, and the media is playing this up as if this is a place that people were afraid to step out of their front door. So we went and talked to a few other people, and a couple of people didn't want to talk to because some people, you know, are maybe also apprehensive about talking to the media because they think that their words are going to be twisted. We really didn't find anyone who said, who had anything about kissing the captain's feet. I'm sure there's some people there who thought that this was a good idea, but most of the people we talked to, actually every single person we talked to, said the raid was over the top. Some of them differed on whether the violence was big or not big. Again, the shootings and the murders are above zero, so any number above zero, you could say, deserves attention. But one young woman that we spoke to, she was with another young man, she was crying because she knew some of the people who were caught up in the raid. And she said these people didn't have anything to do with it, or if they were involved in anything, low-level drug dealing or anything like that, this was years ago. And many of them had served sentences and were already coming back, were starting to raise families. So to the extent that there was even people who were involved, a lot of them were changing their life around. And the raid kind of threw them on these federal racketeering charges that made it sound like they were, like, you know, John Gotti. And the heartbreaking part of it is a lot of these young people don't have lawyers that John Gotti could afford. They didn't even have the opportunity to speak to a lawyer before they were thrown in front of New York Post and Daily News front pages as gangbangers. This is something that I have to say as just being kind of like a city-based writer. Like, I've gone to places and I've seen reporters for local news organizations talk to people who give completely different accounts of what the narrative is, and they won't run it. Like, I've seen it with my own eyes. There was a shooting a couple of years ago. I went over there, I tried to talk to people, and I saw people being interviewed saying things that were like, no, this is not what's happening, this is what's really happening. And local news coverage just won't run it. They'll wait and they'll look for someone that fits the narrative that they're already going in with, and they'll run that. And they'll run it prominently over and over and over and over. And that's why I think it's important to have alternative media be able to come in and say, like, this is what some other people are saying, to at least create some kind of conversation around it, because it's such a completely self-evident. But if you were to read a Daily News article or a New York Post article or a New York Times article, for that matter.
There's a point at which the conversation about protecting a community becomes really demonizing the community. I mean, how are you helping anybody by declaring that their life is defined by wanton violence? We see neighborhoods turned into problems in themselves. It's not the crime, it's the community that becomes the problem. When you talk to community advocates, they have their own ideas about how to improve things in their community. If, say, the question is, gang membership, you know, or violence in public housing? What are some of the things that those community members would point people to that we're maybe not hearing about?
There was a great article in a website called the Juvenile Justice Internet Exchange back in 2014 after the West Harlem raids. And it was actually being written before the raids happened. And the headline said it all. It said, "We asked the city for help, and we got a raid instead." And what people were saying, and what that author and a lot of people had been saying for a long time, is that to the extent that there was violence, community members wanted to steer youth away from violence to begin with, give them other options. In a place where there's virtually no job opportunities, education is crumbling or non-existent, there is a sense amongst a lot of people of color in low-income communities across the city that this just condensation of poverty is at the root of any violence. And again, the violence is being hyped. But to the extent that there is violence, community members wanted an approach that really steered people away and got at root causes, and they were continually ignored over and over. And so what they got instead from the city was a giant raid, because that's what the city understands. That's what the police department understands. And politically, for their own reasons, it was self-serving. They want to show that they're, you know, tough on crime still, you know, even if the crime is a fraction of what it was 20 years ago. And so they place these kids on a basically like a super predator pedestal and frame them in this way. And all of those conversations about after-school programming, community centers that need to be reopened because they've been closed for 5 years. In Manhattanville, which is one of the houses in West Harlem, they had a community center closed for 5 years straight. All of those issues just are completely ignored. Poverty, we don't want to hear it. Opportunities, what's that? Like, it's about the gang raid, it's about the gang member this, gang member that, and that's all it ends up being for the people who hear about this in the media, and that's all they'll ever see about it. That's the double slap in the face. On the one side, you get the raid, and on the other side, you get the media painting your entire life as just revolving around violence.
We've been speaking with Josmar Trujillo. You can find his recent piece, NYPD Raids Won't Solve NYCHA's Violence Problem, on the No Backspace blog at citylimits.org, and Gang Raids and Our Addiction to Super Predators on Huffington Post. Josmar Trujillo, thank you very much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thanks, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information, check out our website, fair.org. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShop.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It's about 90 degrees or 29 Celsius outside my door in the early Canadian spring. Crazy weather. The same superheat that set northern Alberta on fire. We'll talk about the climate connection and ask the question, can the tar sands burn? That's later in this program. First, though it seems less exciting, we're going to begin a series about the most important scientific paper of this new century. Dr. James Hansen led a team of international scientists who completely revised the science of climate change. Seas rising much faster, superstorms in the coming decades, doubling and redoubling of polar ice melt. It's a climate thriller. And we all get to live in this new, disturbed world. I'm Alex. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. The scientist who warned the U.S. Congress about dangerous climate change in 1988 is back. Dr. James Hansen, who recently retired as the head of NASA's Goddard Institute, says we're going to be hit much sooner and harder than we've been told, even by mainstream science. Hansen says the 2 degrees centigrade upper limit to our warming, as agreed at the Paris Climate Summit, is just not unsafe. It's very plainly dangerous for humans and all life as we know it. James Hansen and more than a dozen other world scientists published a monumental 66-page scientific report in March. The title is Ice Melt, Sea Level Rise and Superstorms, Evidence from Paleoclimate Data, Climate Modeling, and Modern Observations that 2 degrees C global warming could be dangerous. The public has hardly heard about the news, and there's a lot to hear. I've called up a regular Radio EcoShock correspondent to help us sort out what this new Hansen paper actually says. Paul Beckwith teaches climate science at the University of Ottawa. He has 2 master's degrees, and he's developing his PhD thesis on abrupt climate change. Paul, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex. It's always a pleasure talking with you.
I appreciate you sharing your expertise so widely. It really, really helps. So James Hansen, perhaps the world's foremost climate scientist, leads this new and shocking interpretation of recent science, and the political and public reaction is crickets, basically. Why is it taking so long for people to get this?
Yeah, I mean, that's the question. I think people they don't want to hear this. It's very dire news, and they just don't want to hear it. I mean, Hansen's talking about main things that he expects will happen this century with a 2 degrees Celsius rise over pre-industrial, which is about another degree. You know, he talks about a lot of different things, but he doesn't talk about methane and he doesn't talk about jet stream waviness. I mean, what he does say is, I think there's 4 or 5 key points that he says will happen this century. And we're starting to see signs of this already. One is cooling of the southern oceans on the surface. And this cooling would slow the southern ocean overturning circulation. And so you have this layer of meltwater on the surface, and the warmer water deeper down would then undercut the ice shelves in Antarctica, for example. And the ice shelves are grounded on retrogressive bedrock. So in other words, as you go deeper inland, the water gets deeper. So they're very unstable, and they act as corks to the main ice sheets on Antarctica. So if the ice shelves start breaking off in large quantities, then it's like taking a cork from a champagne bottle. The ice sheets that are on land that have all this water, which will rapidly raise sea levels, will come off quickly. He also talks about the North Atlantic, the slowing of the AMOC, the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, and even a shutdown this century, and this would cause a great cooling of the North Atlantic. So what this would do is this separation of cold and warm water in the oceans would cause very enormous and powerful storms, because the temperature gradient, very sharp temperature gradients between the cold and the warm water adjacent to each other, cause large pressure gradients, which then cause high winds, and the jet streams pull across there, and you get these massive storms, the likes of which we have not seen. And of course, you also get exponential growth of sea level as opposed to slow linear growth. So we're talking about multimeter sea level rise in time frames of decades as opposed to centuries.
Right. Some of this, he's saying, could start in 2030s, 2040s, and that's pretty unusual when people were generally talking about the year 2100 and beyond.
Yes. Yeah, so he did many simulation models of what would happen if you inject large amounts of fresh water in the North Atlantic from Greenland. And this is also being stimulated because we're actually seeing, we have this cold pool of water south of Greenland, which has been a persistent feature just in the last several years. So what basically happens is the excessive melt of Greenland contributes fresh water to the surface, which then goes into this cold pool. Also, you get either a deflection of the Gulf Stream that cuts across, or the Gulf Stream is forced to go underneath the cold water on the surface, and it does pop up occasionally in different places. You get these large temperature extremes, and then this can give rise to very strong storms. And also, because the jet streams are very wavy, we're often getting ridges or blocking highs over Greenland, so extremely large temperatures over Greenland, and that will greatly increase melt rates of ice on Greenland, which again raises up sea levels. So if you look at the melt rates from Greenland and Antarctica and look at how often the rates double, we have a doubling period from over the last 20 years or so of somewhere between 5 and 8 years. Now, Hansen models doubling periods of 10 years, 20 years, and 40 years, and says that we're heading towards the much lower range of that, so the 10 years. So even with a 10-year doubling time, we're talking about multi-meter sea level rise in a matter of, number of decades, as opposed to, forget 2100, which everybody talks about. In fact, if the doubling rate continues on Greenland and Antarctica, anybody can just calculate that we would have a sea level rise of something like 7 meters by 2070. In fact, I did a video on this just a few years ago. You can just Google that name, can sea level rise 7 meters by 2070? I mean, Hansen's highest number is about 5 meters by 2100, a couple meters possibly, in the next 30 years or so, given this new research that has just been published.
Well, my God, I mean, if we had 2 meters in the next 20 to 30 years, you're talking about Shanghai, New York, Miami disappears, major changes to the Earth.
Yes, I mean, it will basically change the face of the Earth. And, I mean, look at today's rates of sea level rise, over the last decade, compare them to the previous decade. We know how quickly sea level has risen in the past. I mean, it's risen, it has risen 5 meters in 100 years or less in the past, in the paleo records. You can look at the, rates of rise now. We can measure the rates of ice melt using the GRACE anomaly satellites to look at ice melt from Greenland and Antarctica. Also, the ocean temperatures are rising a lot, and we know that when things are at higher temperatures, they expand. So the ocean, the water is taking up more space. Basin size hasn't changed. So this is one of the major sources of sea level rise present day. Greenland and Antarctica are kicking in big time. We're losing Arctic sea ice. In fact, the sea ice is decreasing. It's weeks ahead of where it was in the previous minimum in 2012, and which was way ahead of 2007. So it's very possible that we'll have this blue ocean event where we have no sea ice in the Arctic in September. Of course, this will greatly accelerate the temperature rise in the Arctic, both from the latent heat effect. There's no, ice takes a lot of energy to melt. If the ice is not there, that energy will go and raise the temperature of seawater. And also the albedo is, the Arctic is much darker, it's absorbing much more solar energy. So when we lose sea ice and snow cover is also declining exponentially, then the rates of melt on Greenland will increase, obviously increase at extremely fast rates. And that combined with the undercutting of the glaciers in Antarctica, we're in for a wild ride here. And the unfortunate thing is the public just isn't aware of these risks yet. I mean, the government, we need to declare a climate change emergency. We have a global climate change emergency underway, And we need this declared by governments, and we need strong action taken on an emergency basis. You know, call it a Marshall Plan when we rebuilt damaged countries in World War II, call it a Manhattan Project, call it a moonshot, an Apollo mission. I mean, we're very technologically advanced, but we're doing very, very stupid things now and not recognizing the risks and threats that we face from abrupt climate change.
Well, let's get to one of Dr. Hansen's favorite topics, the coming superstorms. He wrote a book, Storms of My Grandchildren, and I understand he's working on a new book now that will be coming out in the next few months. So to understand this, we have to go back about 130,000 years. What happened then that could warn us now about big storms to come?
Okay, well, what happened was that the global temperature was about 2 degrees above pre-industrial. It was about the level that policymakers now are saying is sort of the safe window, if you like. And it's not safe at all. I mean, during the Eemian, 130,000 years ago, when the temperature was about a degree higher than today, actually even less than a degree, so that's 2 degrees above pre-industrial, the sea levels were 6 to 9 meters higher than they are today, for one thing. So there was, you know, I would guess that probably half of that is from Greenland, half of it is from Antarctica. You know, and there's also a lot more expansion. There's a lot more water vapor in the atmosphere. So for every degree rise in temperature, there's about 7% more water vapor in the atmosphere. So this water vapor fuels much more intense storms. Also, we would definitely have cool regions south of Greenland, cool regions in Antarctica from all that meltwater causing that sea level rise. And those cool regions would lead to extremely high temperature gradients. Those regions would be much colder, and they'd be adjacent to very warm regions. For example, in the north, we'd have the Gulf Stream butting up against the very cold regions, or even the Gulf Stream shutting down. And whenever you get this very strong temperature gradient, you get a lot of baroclinicity. So basically, you get when you have temperature gradients, and you get very, very strong pressure gradients. And then once you have pressure gradients, you get very, very high winds, and that you also have a lot more water vapor in the atmosphere, so that fuels these storms. So these storms then kick up massive waves, and we're talking about 30-meter waves that then carry across the Atlantic and hit down in the Caribbean, hit Bermuda, and even further down. And these 30-meter waves then push up massive boulders onto shorelines, and that's what Hansen documents quite a bit in his paper. So we have storms the likes of which we have never seen before in human history on our planet.
And as you point out in your YouTube video on the Hansen paper, that ships were never built to face a 100-foot wave, a 30-meter wave, so that could end shipping, say, at least around the Caribbean and maybe in other places as well.
Yes. While those storms were occurring, occasionally now we get these rogue waves, which are, 100-foot waves, and we can detect them by satellite. They're not as rare as people think. I mean, at any given time, there might be, half a dozen to a dozen going on. And these are 30-meter waves. And the rogue waves, they build up from superposition of waves, et cetera. You know, the statistics of wave motion in the oceans. But to have, wave trains, 30-meter waves in wave trains, not talking about a single wave, but a group of wave trains. I mean, think of the devastation that they would do to shorelines, especially with a sea level rise, meters higher than what it is now. I mean, this is what the science tells us we're heading to. I mean, this Hansen paper is kind of a landmark, and, he published it sort of online as open source about, last summer, and I did the 9 videos on it trying to dissect it. And, now it's being published officially to the peer review in Atmospheric Chemistry and Physics. It's an open access paper, so anybody can just Google the name of the paper, load the paper up on their computer, read the, there's a lot of technical details in it, but anybody in the public, just read the abstract, read the beginning, the intro, look at some of the figures and read the conclusions, and you can get the gist of the paper. Also, Hansen did a 15-minute video recently trying to explain some of the key points of this paper. So, we definitely are facing the consequence of abrupt climate change at the moment. But as bad as the paper is, it doesn't mention methane. I mean, there's 5 gigatons of methane in the atmosphere right now. There's 100 gigatons on the eastern Siberian Arctic shelf. So even if 1% of that was released from the warming seawater, which would occur, you know, if we lose sea ice and snow cover, you know, we have the blue ocean event, the oceans are warming, they're already warming 5 to 7 degrees over these continental shelves. You know, 1% of the methane, you know, on the upper surface comes through, whether it be in clath rates or decomposing permafrost, organic matter in the permafrost, and 1% would be 10 gigatons, and that would double the methane level in the atmosphere. And this is an enormous feedback because on a few-year time scale, you know, the global warming potential is, you know, 150, 200 times that of CO2. So methane starts coming out, then the Arctic temperatures will skyrocket. All of these cascading feedbacks kick in, you know, and, you know, we're on a wild roller coaster ride. And, you know, people can follow. I mean, I advocate strongly for, you know, three-legged bar stools type solutions. We need to zero fossil fuel emissions on an emergency basis, but that's not sufficient. That's leg one of the metaphorical climate bar stool. We also need to remove CO2 from the atmosphere with CDR methods, and we need to cool the Arctic with solar radiation management methods. And that gives us a fighting chance to restore a, you know, climate change restoration of a more stable climate.
Well, yes, listeners, I sometimes disagree with Paul about geoengineering, or although I'm starting to lean in his direction as I see this emergency develop. But certainly, Paul's got a really good grip on abrupt climate change, and that's what this paper is about, I think. We've been discussing what might be the biggest scientific paper of this decade, if not this century. It's from a team of scientists led by the famous Dr. James Hansen. The title is Ice Melt, Sea Level Rise and Superstorms, and I won't read the rest of the title. It's a long one. I'll be doing more interviews and analysis as we go along, and Dr. Hansen has just agreed to do an interview for Radio EcoShock. I know that Paul did a 9-part series of YouTube videos on this paper. I'll put a link to them in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Or, folks, you can just go to YouTube and search for Beckwith and Hansen, and there they are. And also, of course, you've got to go to paulbeckwith.net, his website, where you can get all kinds of goodies and keep up with Paul and his Facebook page. I look at his Facebook page at least every second day, if not every day, to get some more clues about what's going on with the climate. Paul's from the University of Ottawa. He's been really, really helpful to Radio EcoShock. Paul, thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much, Alex.
Radio EcoShock.
Yes, Isabella Velikonia is a co-author on the new paper led by James Hansen. She's also a power researcher in her own right. Educated in Italy, Isabella has a collection of roles with NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab, the Ceres Institute at the University of Colorado, and she's an associate professor of Earth System Science at the University of California, Irvine, and that's where we've reached her. On Radio EcoShock, you have heard me talk about a pair of satellites called GRACE. These twins in space can measure changes of gravity in the land, in subsurface waters even, and ice at the poles. Isabella Velikonia can use that information to, as she says, study the mass balance of the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets and glaciers worldwide in response to climate warming. That's just part of her expertise, including research on the high Arctic water cycle, projections of sea level rise due to climate change, and all this fits perfectly into the new publication that is rocking the science world. It's a long paper with a long title, and the title is Ice Melt, Sea Level Rise and Superstorms, Evidence from Paleoclimate Data, Climate Modeling, and Modern Observations that 2 degrees C warming could be dangerous. Isabella Velikonia, welcome to Radio EcoShock. So what role did you play in this paper?
So as you said, I done a lot of work looking at the data of the GRACE satellite. And so in the paper, what I did, I used this data set, this observation. They are very special because they can basically measure the change. We can use them to measure the change in mass of the ice sheets. And so see how much they are losing mass, or they are increasing mass, if that was the case. And I've been using this data to calculate the mass losses from the Antarctic and Greenland ice sheets since 2002, so for a little bit more than 10 years, about 13 years.
And do we know what the net volume of ice or water lost from the whole of Antarctica was, say, last year?
So when we look at the ice sheets, we don't really think exactly one year, because it's a little bit like when we look at climate, we don't think how it was, you know, last year. We look at an average, what's happening over an average in time. But yes, so what we know, if we look, for example, from the data that we use on in the mass loss over the past 10 years or so, we can see that there is an average mass loss. On average, if I do the average between 1 year and another during this period, it's about 86 gigaton per year. That's a gigaton, just to have an idea, is how much water, for example, all LA County, which is a big city, uses in 1 year to basically do everything, you know, the population needs for agriculture, people showering, water the lawn, company to use. So it's a lot of water when we talk about 86 on average. But I think that more than looking, you know, how much ice is lost in 1 year is more important to the things that I think we are very, I don't know if it excited is the war. Scientists get excited about discovering things that, you know, and especially when you study something and it change faster. It's pretty cool from a scientist's point of view, is that this mass loss is not the same every year. You know, we find that it's increasing actually every year. So if we have an average of, you know, 86, for example, gigaton per year between, say, in 10 years, this is about the average mass that you have, you know, in the middle of this period. But really, if you look at the more recent year, every year, what we find that, for example, in Antarctica, based on this 14 years period that we have from GRACE, we get about 70 gigaton additional every year, which is quite a bit.
It is a lot, and I'm interested that it's increasing every year because so is the global temperature, as far as we can understand. Now, one thing that was described in the paper is a phenomenon of how cold meltwater seems to be forming a cap that is somehow driving warmer water deeper under the glaciers. Did I understand that correctly, and how does it work?
Well, you know, it's not very surprising, I guess, for scientists, because they, you know, what's occurring in both polar regions. What happened in the polar region is that actually the cold water is on top and the warmer water is at the bottom. And this is, you know, it's like normally when you go in the tropic, usually you do have warmer water on the top and colder water on the bottom. But this is, you know, this is not the condition around the polar region and closer to the ice. And for this reason, the warm water is you can say dangerously, you know, to add a little bit of suspense, closer to the glacier. What really pushes, drives the water, the warmer water, closer to the glacier is the wind pattern, how the wind are changing. So what happened is that the wind, what we are observing is that given how the water has, so we have the colder water on top and warmer water on the bottom, if the wind change, you know, the wind pattern can move the colder water and they allow the warmer water to get closer to the glacier. And that's not good because if you have warmer water at depth, ice turns out, you know, you need a smaller change in the heat of your water to melt ice at depth because the pressure is higher.
For a long time, scientists focused on West Antarctica, saying East Antarctica was for now more or less immune to climate change. And then we heard maybe that isn't so. What is happening in East Antarctica?
So I think that people have been, and scientists have been more focused on West Antarctica because West Antarctica has a lower elevation and we have more observation of more dynamic change, faster change in some region. A lot of the glacier are, most of the West Antarctica is grounded below sea level, so it's basically is a marine grounded, so it's below sea level, so it's more easier to melt, you know, once it starts melting. And East Antarctica has much higher elevation, and there is now a big portion grounded below sea level. But what we are observing the, I guess people start to realize, and I think it's a while that we know, but on the other hand, if you look at East and West Antarctica, East Antarctica is much larger than West Antarctica. And so even if the, you know, proportionally to the entire East Antarctica, there are smaller portion, they are grounded below sea level, they can contribute a lot to the total sea level rise. For example, you know, when we think about West Antarctica, we talk about there's a sector that's been, people have been talking a lot about, there's the Amundsen Sea sector, and it's really losing mass very fast, and if it just really collapse, which, you know, it seems very dramatic, but, you know, collapse in the ice sheet timescale occur in a relative long time. But this sector, which is one of the larger sectors, the more unstable in West Antarctica, can contribute about 1 meter of sea level. And this is the combination of many glaciers. If we move to East Antarctica, there are some sectors which are grounded below sea level. It means that, you know, they are attached to the bedrock. The ice is attached to the bedrock, but is below the mean sea level, right? So those are very vulnerable. Once, you know, we have warmer water, they get closer to the glaciers. So only one of those glaciers, for example, where we are observing an increase in warm water getting closer to the glacier, can contribute. This would be like Totem Glacier, which is in East Antarctica. Just this one glacier alone would contribute, if it collapsed, about 3.9 meter, almost 4 meter of global sea level. So point being that although it's considered overall more stable, East Antarctica, it has some sector that can be very vulnerable to climate-induced changes. And we are observing, you know, that along those regions, we are observing some, you know, warmer water getting closer to the glacier, and this tells us that we should watch out.
Moving ahead, in general, we've heard again and again that deglaciation has been underestimated, particularly by the IPCC. Isabella Velikonia, do you agree?
Yes, so I agree with this. And there is an underestimate when we look at those reports. And the reason why this is the case is that those assessments are based on deterministic models. So their model, they are as good as possible at the present, but there is a general understanding in the community that they are missing some key physical processing. And that doesn't mean that, you know, the scientists don't know what they're doing. It means that we are working toward improving those models, but because of the complexity of the ice sheet, because of the observation that we have in a lot of places, not enough. They, by comparing the projection that those models, the result from those models in terms of in terms of estimate of sea level rise from the ice sheets, they are underestimating what we are observing. And so if those models are used for making prediction, is intrinsically we know that they are going to underestimate what is the contribution of the glacier to sea level.
Where do you think this is all going, say, in our lifetimes, whatever that may mean, and say, by the end of the century? Are we going to see meaningful change at the poles, or is this something that's going to take 500 years, 1,000 years, or longer?
Well, I would say we are already seeing meaningful changes at the poles. It depends what we see with meaningful, but definitely the ice sheets are already showing us changes, you know, that we can see. I think that what we are expecting, you know, for the end of the century, I would say I believe that very likely we're going to get more than 1 meter of sea level change. And when I say 1 meter, I talk about, in you know, generally overall 1 meter, but I think that is generally understood that the ice sheets are really going to control most of this sea level change. And so they are like the big player in the game. And so point being that I think we're going to get more than 1 meter based on what we see, you know, we know that we expect changes in the climate and in what we are observing from the ice. It could be, on the other hand, higher than more than 1 meter. And, you know, there can be as high as 2 meter in principle. And this is depend on how fast the ice sheet are going to change. And that's not, you know, we don't have a certain answer to that. What we know that things can happen way faster than from the past, from what we know from the past that we are observing now. But it's complicated to be able to make prediction and have a very certain timeline.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest Isabella Velikonia, an ice and sea level expert from the University of California, Irvine. Isabella, when it comes to polar ice loss, do you think we have reached the stage of unstoppable or irreversible?
I would say that for some regions of the ice sheets, we have. Not for all the region. And what that means, it means that we are locked in on some changes. So there are some changes in sea level, some increase in sea level that I think we are locked in and are going to happen based on those regions where we feel that, you know, we are reached the stage of unstoppable. But on the other hand, we don't know how fast we're going to get there. On the other hand, what it says also is that we don't want to get to the unstoppable, irreversible stage for the entire ice sheet. So we should really work hard to try to slow down the process and try to, you know, manage it as much as possible.
Let's get back to the influential paper you co-authored with James Hansen and a team of other scientists. One impression I got from Dr. Hansen's video abstract of the paper that he published on YouTube is that he finds science is failing to keep up with reality. For example, models don't appear to capture measured changes in the ocean. Isabella, do you think science is broken, or do we need to extend our vision of it?
Well, I don't know if I would say that science is failing to keep up with reality. I would say that, you know, science is a big word, but I would just agree that how the results from our scientific work are presented, maybe they are not highlighting all the uncertainty in what we estimated. And so I think that the value, you know, as I was saying before, you know, we have those estimates based on models, but the model has weaknesses, and we know that there are those weaknesses, and we know that, you know, those uncertainty, you know, are also difficult to quantify. And from observation, on the other hand, we know that, that things are happening way faster. So I guess the point is that I would not say the science is broken. I would say that maybe it would be scientists are not doing the best job in presenting what are the uncertainty, and the message that comes across is a message that seems contradictory, while it's not.
So how important do you think this new Hansen-led paper is compared to some of the other science so far this century? Is this a big one or just another paper?
So what I see is really the important message of this paper, and again, it's one paper. What it tells us is that 2-degree increase in temperature is not a safe spot. And we know that after Paris, you know, there's been an agreement, let's try to keep temperature to less than 1 degree, 1.5, and even 1.5, actually, from what we know, is not necessarily a safe limit. And I think that that's the big message that came across from the paper. And this is based on, in the paper Jim did, together with all the other authors, he did an incredible work in trying to put in together a lot of scientists and analyze different aspects of modeling, and trying to highlight the uncertainty associated with that, and looking at the observation and trying to highlight what is this are bringing up as a difference. And I think the big message out of the paper is that mostly because of the megastorm that could occur, the sea level rise, 2 degrees is really an unsafe limit, you know, respect increase in temperature respect to the pre-industrial area. And so we really don't want to just feel safe there. We have to just kind of be prepared and try to see what we can do in a positive way, not that necessarily in a dramatic way. You know, it's just things are going to happen. We are locked in changes. There's a lot of inertia in climate variability, in how the ice sheet responds to climate. So if we are locked in changes, you know, in what's going to happen for probably the next 100 years, probably more, we want to start to just make, you know, as much effort as we can to slow down the process.
You talk about in a positive way, but do you worry about the future?
I do. I think that we should, but I don't try to worry. I think that one of the main problems sometimes is people, I don't want people to say, oh my God, what's going to happen? I worry in the sense that, you know, I know that we are set from science, you know, when you said, oh, is the science broken? I think that from observation and science, we know that from the past, we know that the ice sheets, one of the big results of the Earth-facing IPCC was that we know that during the last interglacial maximum, when the temperature was about 1.5 to 2.5 degrees higher than what is now, which is where we are heading at the end of the century, the sea level was 5 to 9 meters higher than the present, and most of this sea level increase was coming from the ice sheets. So my point is more like we should be worried, you know, a little bit worried, as things don't happen, you know, from today to tomorrow in climate. To some extent, we have some freedom to adapt and to try to mitigate those changes and get ready. So I am worried if we are not starting to understand that we have to act and do something to slow down and to just try to prevent bigger changes.
Is there anything that I've missed that you would like to leave with our listeners?
I think one thing that sometimes I'm not sure the listener have clear is that scientists don't really have an agenda when they look at those things. You know, we are having, if you want, fun, try to understand how the Earth works and what are, you know, the processes that govern those changes and how they're changing under different forcing, under different climate scenarios. So I don't think that as scientists, we have a secret agenda, you know, for why we're saying what's happening, you know, what's going to happen. To some extent, you know, it's almost more fun for us to have this very complicated problem to solve and to understand, and the fact that we don't have a model that we can push the button and tells us what's going to happen. So we are trying, when we just communicate with the public or we just try to just say, oh, we have new funding, it's not necessarily because, you know, we wanted to create a panic or we want to just be spectacular or we have any other second mean. We're just trying to communicate, look, we are improving our understanding of what is happening, and what we are seeing tells us that we should really watch out and be careful. Maybe not necessarily for us, you know, me, you, or but no, for the generation of my kids and on the kids of my kids. I think we have a responsibility for that and for our planet.
From the University of California, Irvine, we've been speaking with Isabella Valacogna. She's an associate professor of Earth System Science who also works with NASA and the Ceres Institute in Colorado. As a polar ice melt and sea level specialist, Isabella is a co-author of the new paper on ice melt, sea level rise, and superstorms. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thank you to you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. With me again is Paul Beckwith, our regular EcoShock correspondent. He's from the University of Ottawa, a climate scientist, teaches climate science there. And we've both been shocked by a sudden event in Canada where the major city that houses and feeds and supports the tar sands, as I call them, or the oil sands, as others call them, in Alberta, has had to be totally evacuated due to a major fire just rushing in on the town practically with no notice. People couldn't even find enough gasoline at the pumps to get out of town. It was one of those emergency situations we all dread. Paul, I put a video up on YouTube saying, let's face it, folks, we can't keep doing this. We can't keep producing energy using the tar sands. It's one of the most polluting forms of energy in the world. And as we both know, the climate is going to heck in a handbasket. So I've already received my share of abuse. What do you think, Paul?
Well, I think I'll have to join you with the video myself so that, you know, some of the abuse can be spread around. I mean, you know, people need to understand, as bad as the inferno was in Fort Mac, and I just heard this morning, of course, they evacuated 80,000 people last night, and this morning I've heard that there's over 1,600 structures in the city that have burned down, many neighborhoods and so on. And this is a city that was basically, you know, positioned right in the middle of a boreal forest. You know, because of climate change, the jet stream behavior is changing, and we're getting these ridges and troughs in the jet stream. We're getting blocking events. We're getting very warm regions with no rainfall in some of these events where there's persistent blocking. For example, over Fort McMurray, the temperature for, you know, early May is 32 degrees Celsius, and this is 22 degrees Celsius over the normal average temperature for this time of year. And in fact, it's 12 degrees Celsius over the previous maximum temperature on these particular days, May 3rd, May 4th. And there's been lack of rainfall. First of all, there wasn't much snow in the winter. There was a very low snowpack. Then we got these very extreme temperatures in early spring. So the vegetation is all dried out. And we also know that climate change has cut off the low temperatures in winter. So we have pine beetle and we have emerald ash borer and we have all these other things which decrease the resilience and strength of forests. So these boreal forests are prone to fire, and that happened, and Fort McMurray happened to be in the way. So I would argue that Fort McMurray is just the latest city to fall in the climate casino. The probability of extreme weather events has increased in frequency, severity, and duration. And these weather events are having huge implications on societies, on cities. last night it was Fort McMurray. I would argue that Canada overnight suddenly has 80,000 climate refugees from Alberta. We've been helping Syrian climate refugees because there was a massive drought 2006-2011 that drove 1.5 million people from rural areas into cities, and they lost their livelihoods. And Canada's been taking lots of Syrian refugees. Well, we have 80,000 refugees from Alberta as of last night.
Well, you know, we had massive fires around my home last summer. We had fire evacuees even staying in our house here. And I've seen what fires can do to people when their homes are burned, when their livelihoods are burned. And psychically, it's very difficult for people. There was a 9-year-old kid who wouldn't get out of his pickup truck. He just felt like he had to be able to get away at any time, even though he was out of the fire zone. So I really, really feel for the people of Fort McMurray. I'm not trying to be harsh when I say this, but the fact is we should have shut down the tar sands a long time ago. It's helping to ruin the climate for all of our kids. We all have to fear the future now, and that's what it's boiling down to. So I'm saying let's take this as an opportunity to rethink these tar sands, get Alberta going into alternative energy. They've already got good wind power going there. They could be building wind machines. They've got to do whatever they can rather than put out more of this tar sands oil. It's too dangerous.
Yes, it will be a big mistake to just completely rebuild that area and continue with tar sands extraction. As you say, the wind power is expanding in leaps and bounds in Alberta. You know, solar power, of course, is massive. But they also have an enormous geothermal energy potential in Alberta. And there's lots of holes in the ground that have just been plugged up at the surface. And these could be used, these could be retrofitted for geothermal power systems. And that could power lots of the provincial economy. It could generate lots of jobs. The skill set of a lot of people in the mining industries, extraction industries, could be transferred directly to developing an enormous geothermal industry. And this is an area of power which is completely underutilized in Canada. And I'm not sure why. I mean, I guess it's because of the other industries that have been more profitable to companies. And, you know, it's tragic. I mean, the fire is tragic, as you say, people losing their homes. I mean, I feel for those people, but I see the bigger picture. And, you know, I've been watching the fires in the Himalayas for the last month, massive fires in India, you know, in the foothills of the Himalayas. And they don't have any water to put those fires out. And people are losing their homes there and so on. And yet, you know, there's no noise, there's no news or anything about this in Canada. You know, the people that had to evacuate all of their homes in Houston from the massive flooding just a month ago or less, this was another case of extreme climate events. I see the big picture about this. And, you know, as we're all under threat, I mean, we can all be Fort McMurray in terms of disasters falling upon our cities. You know, nobody is immune, no city is immune. And to not even recognize the root cause of what is happening with these extreme weather events and these events which take down cities is idiocy. You know, I mean, it's just ignoring reality to not make those connections between what is happening.
And the media is not going to tell the public. I mean, you won't see any stories about the jet stream, the low Arctic sea ice and the impact that has on the weather, the fact that the climate is warming and we're into another record year, that it was outrageously hot in Fort McMurray and all around there. You won't hear about it on the news. What you'll hear about is the sadness of some family that lost their family home. And, you know, it's sort of strange because some of those homes were $500,000 for a shack to be in Fort McMurray, just because of the oil industry, and then there were a lot of layoffs there, and the real estate crashed, and now it's burned, literally. Very strange events there.
Yeah, it's also strange because, you know, I just saw a tweet from Elizabeth May and from other people that are saying, you know, send $5 to help the people in Fort McMurray, you know, send $10. You know, people have lost their homes. And yes, I mean, people, the communities come together from other regions, from Alberta. You know, Trudeau's gone on and talked about federal aid to Alberta. None of these people are saying, okay, these companies that are just north of Fort McMurray that have hired these people, make more profit than any other companies in the world, just about, not since the oil prices plummeted, but before. And I don't see any call to have these companies financially support all of the people that have been affected, that have lost their town, that have lost their livelihoods. I mean, people, there's calls to the public, you know, across Canada to support financially people that have been hit by the disaster. But what about, where's the calls to have these companies be responsible for, you know, what's happening, right? Because they're the root cause of these changes to the chemistry of our atmosphere.
Well, but that's the deal, Paul. That's the deal. The companies make the profits, the investors take them back home, and then when there's climate-induced damage, the public is supposed to pay for it.
Yes. I mean, the system is completely broken. It's not, you know, I don't know. I mean, it seems that the human brain is not capable of understanding the big picture of climate change, you know, and dealing with it, at least up to now. I mean, we're not inspiring much confidence that we're going to deal with these problems. Of course, that can change on a dime, you know, if there's a tipping point in human understanding of these threats and, you know, behaviors change. And, you know, this is what I'm hopeful will eventually happen. You know, maybe it'll take a completely blue ocean in the Arctic, no sea ice, with these extreme weather events ramping up an order of magnitude or something.
And you and I are trying every day, basically, to get this message out, and we hope that it will reach some of the people in Fort McMurray as well, to rethink your future and look for a greener path for the sake of your kids and your grandkids and my kids and my grandkids. We've all got to do this. Paul, is there anything you'd like to add about the Fort McMurray situation as we wrap this up?
These events, you know, are becoming more and more frequent and more severe and affecting more and more people around the planet. So, you know, I would just encourage everybody on this planet to try to look at these events as part of a big picture, you know, as part of a big puzzle or something, or of the whole chess game, not just one particular move in the chess game, but the whole chess game. And the whole chess game is the climate system and how it's changing.
Yeah, and we're going to have to avoid seeing it as entertainment, as a game on the news where you watch the next community burn down or be flooded out or have seas crashing over it, and that makes for excellent television and exciting times to live in, but it's not a good thing. It's not a good path forward. I think we both can agree with that. We're talking with Paul Beckwith, one of my favorite correspondents with Radio EcoShock. He's at the University of Ottawa. Be sure and visit paulbeckwith.net to find all his videos and his Facebook page. I'll put links to all of that at ecoshock.info. Thank you so much, Paul.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Breaking news, Bloomberg reports smoke from the fire complex reached the tar sands operations of Suncor just north of Fort McMurray. Already the size of Luxembourg, the fire is expected to double in size in 24 hours. It may burn for months, since only prolonged rain can stop it. The Canadian Bank of Montreal has revised Canada's economic prospects downward. As more tar sands production facilities close, millions of barrels of oil per day have stopped flowing. As a world-class superfire, this will be Canada's most expensive natural disaster, with expected costs over $7 billion U.S. and counting. I said we must avoid seeing the climate crisis as entertainment. The news knows how to show a striking video with music that makes us feel part of great events. They know we will flock to the news coverage and then see their advertising to buy more products that are part of the problem. It's our human nature to be fascinated with catastrophe, and so climate disaster sells. Even greens become glued to extreme weather porn generated by an unstable atmosphere. Who can look away? We are also drawn to something new. Here is a new question for you. Can the tar sands operations burn, and what happens if they do? In his blog, Robert Scribler writes, quote, "Smoke plume analysis indicates that the northern extent of this monstrous fire is just 3 miles to the south of the nearest tar sands facility. Now the big blotches of tar sands production lands have been mostly deforested, which is part of their massive environmental damage. So there are fewer trees to burn there. But my question Can the tar sands lands themselves burn? We have gigantic tailings and wastewater ponds which are loaded with various types of flammable petrochemicals. We have storage tanks full of flammable stuff. And along those lines, I heard a television interview with a fire chief who worried that a gas storage plant near the fire could explode. If it did, he said, the blast zone would be 14 kilometers wide or 8.5 miles. Emergency workers are just terrified it could blow. And this is one of 1,000 reasons why the people evacuated from Fort McMurray won't be going home anytime soon. The Canadian magazine Maclean's asks this question in their article, Could the Oil Sands Catch Fire? They write, quote, a 2004 article in the U.S. National Fire Protection Association Journal offered a list of the potential fire risks faced by Suncor Energy, one of the oil sands' biggest producers. It included hydrogen spill and pressure fires, storage tank fires, vapor cloud explosions, flammable gas fires, runaway exothermic reactions, and coke and sulfur fires, end quote. The article quotes Chelsea Klassen from the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers saying the toxic tailing ponds are not themselves flammable. I'm not so sure. Maybe we'll find out. What about the giant extraction and processing facilities? Presumably there are pits the size of cities where the tarry bitumen has been exposed by skimming off up to 75 feet of the soil. If those pits catch fire, is it possible that, like peat fires, they could burn for years? Just consider the amount of carbon this would add to the atmosphere, and the lasting smoke which would pour across Western Canada for how long? Years? A decade? Is it possible? We don't know. This situation has never happened before. I hope we don't find out. But we might experience a new kind of fire event in Canada, a kind of fire Fukushima. Beyond the strip mining bitumen, the other type of extraction called in situ involves sinking pipes and literally melting the ground below to make the sticky tar more mobile so it can be pumped up to the surface. That requires unbelievable amounts of natural gas, which has often been fracked in northern Alberta and British Columbia. That fracking and the transmission of gas releases very potent methane in amounts that can be measured by airplanes and even satellites. So there's lots of greenhouse gases before the extraction process even begins. Then the gas is burned, with more emissions. There must be gigantic gas storage facilities and feeder pipelines all through that area just north of Fort McMurray. We're talking about land the size of smaller European countries. If the fire reaches all that, the explosions and greenhouse emissions would be off the charts, things not seen before on this planet. What if the tar sands operations catch fire and blow? Maybe it won't happen this time. It's a huge risk. Tonight, while walking, I met a local citizen who told me the tar sands are a clean source of fuel because Canada has regulations, while there are no environmental regulations in the Middle Eastern country, he said. He obviously doesn't know the highly polluting energy train required to get sticky bitumen out of the ground, whether you mine it or you melt it. Even then, it isn't oil. It's a kind of pre-oil. That bitumen has to be treated with hydrogen at very high temperatures, blast furnace temperatures, again using tremendous energy with tremendous emissions to get a heavy prequel to oil. Transport that oil prequel using more energy to specialized refineries that can deal with heavy oil, which is again a more intensive process with more emissions, and you get products like diesel fuel. That's all there is to it, compared to the light oil that can be easily pumped out of the ground in the Middle East or from the seabed off Norway, and it's more easy to refine. That is why oil from wells requires about 1 barrel of oil to produce up to 100 barrels of oil, while the tar sands require the equivalent of about 1 barrel of oil to produce at best 5 barrels of oil. That ratio is so low that if all we had was tar sands oil, civilization as we know it would collapse. There isn't enough return on energy investment to have all the energy left over that we depend on. That is why the tar sands oil is among the dirtiest energy sources from an emissions perspective of any fuel in the world. Even most Canadians don't know this. The people whose paychecks depend directly on the Alberta energy industry don't want to know. In fact, many react with surprising anger when you tell them. And they can say with a straight face that black is white, that tar sands oil is cleaner than oil from Venezuela or Norway. As the American author Upton Sinclair said, it is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it. Here the Fort McMurray tragedy becomes another repetition of classic human error. After every disaster, every politician from local to national promises, "We will rebuild." That's what they said after Hurricane Sandy or Hurricane Katrina. That's what they always say. They'll even rebuild cities right on the coast where the next hurricane and storm surge will wash over right again. Fort McMurray was already entering a stage of collapse when the fire hit. Rebuilding everything is the bridge to nowhere. Look, I have family who evacuated from Fort McMurray with nothing but their car, their kids, and their dog. The harsh truth is that many, many people in Fort McMurray were one credit card payment away from utter bankruptcy. Tens of thousands of jobs were lost as expensive oil was crushed by cheap Middle Eastern oil and cheap fracking oil. The sad truth is that most Canadians, who used to be great savers, instead became addicted to debt. They built many mansions in the northern wilderness at inflated prices. They bought monster pickup trucks for $70,000 each on 8-year payment schemes. They bought off-road vehicles, boats, clothes, the lot, mostly on credit, because a person with a high school education could make over $100,000 a year. Fort McMurray became a party that could never end. Drug use and drug crime was phenomenal for the size of the city. It was all ripe for a fall, and it fell. Countless evacuees are showing up on the news with absolutely nothing. After 10 years or more of working in the gold mine that was the tar sands, they were on the edge of bankruptcy with no savings, and now they're climate evacuees who don't know they're climate evacuees. The heartache is just beginning. The bill to the taxpayer is just beginning. This will take years to sort out, and some people will never recover. The people of Fort McMurray will fade out of the headlines, perhaps pushed out by the next extreme weather event or giant storm we can all watch. But the blow to Alberta and Canada will go on and on. It's come to the point where trees are now a threat to any city. My own home could be next, or yours. There's practically nowhere that cannot burn out of control. Ask people in Australia, California, or the Himalayas, Indonesia, almost anywhere. I'm sure some cities will try to cut down the forest around them, maybe even limit tree planting within city limits. That just releases more carbon, reduces the ability of trees to absorb carbon dioxide, and it won't work anyway. As Paul Beckwith says, we have entered the age of the climate casino. You could be the next climate evacuee. No city is safe from some sort of climate extreme. Nobody is immune. The only solution is to recognize reality and tackle the root of the problem. That means converting away from fossil fuel based in our civilization. That process begins with closing down the worst and most polluting forms of fossil fuels. At the top of that list are two fuels, coal and the tar sands. Coal in Western countries is going bankrupt. It still fuels most of India, China, and much of the developing world. That story is far from over. The tar sands could shut down tomorrow, and the oil glut would still continue. We don't need them. Canada must stop promising to rebuild that deadly infrastructure, stop subsidizing the dirtiest oil, and we must adopt a plan to close down these facilities entirely within 5 years, if not immediately. That's what it takes, and the alternative is to keep on suffering, if we can keep on at all. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock for the world. Here is the bit of music I wrote for this show. It's called Anti-Cruise. I'll toss it on SoundCloud. You can download it separately if you want.
Sander Hicks, welcome. Pleasure as always.
Thank you, Don. Thanks for having me on your show.
So let's talk about this event.
Great. Well, we are inspired. It's called Incandescent Compassion, a benefit concert for Doctors Without Borders in Syria. You know, Syria was in the headlines quite extensively with all the refugee crisis in Europe that was caused by United States imperialism. And so we're doing something about it. We're getting some really great radical musicians together. My own band, White Collar Crime, with David Rovix, one of the greatest anti-war singer-songwriters of all time.
Yeah,
he's on a
great
world tour. So we've got David Rovix, Jeffrey Lewis, Dean Killian, Sparrow, and the band Mobile Steam Unit.
Yeah, and Jeffrey's video, by the way, is the coolest claymation rock video I think I've ever seen.
Isn't it great? Yeah, Jeffrey Lewis is quite a genius. I got into him because I heard him first on the Pandora channel for Kimya Dawson. So if people like Kimya Dawson, you'll love Jeffrey Lewis and vice versa. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I'm glad you saw that, Don.
Yeah, it was cool.
So let me get the quick who, what, where out of the way. It's March 15th. It's at Pianos in the Lower East Side
of New York City.
New York City. Exactly. So fly in from wherever you are into the city of New York on a cheap flight and get here Tuesday night, March 15th. Starts at 7, ends at midnight. It's at Pianos in the Lower East Side of Manhattan.
And if you're in town for that, you might as well hang out for the St. Paddy's Day Parade on Thursday.
Exactly. Get your gay self down to St. Paddy's Day.
So who are you raising money for and why?
Well, it's Doctors Without Borders, which is a really great progressive group. You know, they've ticked off Israel for being insufficiently pro-Israeli, and that's all right by me. They've done work in the occupied territories. They've done work worldwide as a humanitarian organization that provides, medical attention to underprivileged people, refugees, poor people. Recently one of their hospitals was even bombed by the United States aggression in Syria. Right. So this is a great way to do something about it.
And this isn't the first bit of political work that you've been working on that we've discussed. Maybe you could give people an idea of some of the things you've been involved with in New York.
I'm best known as an independent publisher and the founder of Soft Skull Press. We took on the Bush family in 1999, trying to prevent George W. Bush from taking power and stealing an election. And we republished a book called Fortunate Son by the late, great Jim Hatfield. Since went on to become a writer of the truth about the 9/11 attacks. I've done two books on that subject. My most recent book is called Slingshot to the Juggernaut, in which I also try to explore direct action spirituality as an alternative to aggression and insanity and genocide.
What is that? What's direct action spirituality?
Oh, yeah, I know exactly. What is it? I know. I try to meditate a lot. I try to question my own illusions. I try to do things that I'm trying to get society to do. So I try to make it personal and political. So I try not to live by a me first, me-aholic kind of attitude in which my opinion is God's holy truth. And, I just try to get my own ego out of the way as a way to kind of build up my incandescent compassion. You know, I think we're all capable of a really bright, luminous compassion. And I kind of came across this phrase somewhere, incandescent compassion. And that's why this event on March 15th is called Incandescent Compassion. So I think we're all capable of an incredible, powerful, bright, new way, nonviolence. I've been talking a lot in my most recent book about how the USA really could be a leader of nonviolence. You know, we could be like Ashoka, the president of India in 300 BC. It was this guy who actually said, nonviolence is not just a great spiritual practice in our spiritual lineage, but it's actually a great political practice, And so India became this country of nonviolence. And that's why on the Indian flag, it has this big wheel and it's the wheel of Ashoka. So it's time for the USA to reorient itself redirect itself. And sure. I think the Eastern traditions of that Orient word are a great guidepost. So I think our rigid Christianity is up for a revolutionary change to be influenced by yoga, by Zen, by meditation. And, and I love Jesus. I'm not saying that Christianity is part of the problem. I think actually it's part of the solution. But I think, like Gandhi said, I think the we don't need a new religion, but there is great truth and nonviolence at the core of the world's great religions as they exist right now. Even Islam is like all about surrender to the will of the all, the divine that is uniting, a uniting force of truth. So that is, I feel that the phrase direct action is not out of place either. I'm the guy that built the big altar for Occupy Wall Street and donated this giant piece of maple and cherry wood. And we, had this kind of this altar in which was, it was very democratic. Anybody could put something on the altar and it became very cluttered in a beautiful way of this collaborative artwork that was about almost like a collective direct action spirituality. Mm-hmm. And so direct action of like an immediate dropping away of illusion, an immediate attempt to connect is kind of like the spirit of Occupy, and it's the spirit of what I'm all about too.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds more like the word spiritual would relate to cultural rather than metaphysical, which is an interesting spin on it. Looking at some of the other things, I know the referendum that you've worked on a few times over the years.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's. I'm glad you asked about that.
It's direct action.
Yeah, direct action. Yeah, you're probably talking about trying to get a new investigation of 9/11. We've had a couple of different ballot referendums in the history of activism in New York City. And now I'm still working with HR14.org and Les Jamison, because there's actually, it's pretty incredible, but there's a very mainstream piece of legislation in Congress. There's like, it's got bipartisan support. There's over 42 congressional supporters now, people that are in Congress, elected members of Congress who are backing this. And this is to release the 28 pages. This is what the 28 pages were from Congress's joint inquiry report into 9/11, the predecessor of the 9/11 commission report. And you might have heard about this. It's pretty famous because Michael Moore talks a little bit about this.
Well,
this
one senator said if that had been public, a whole bunch of things that have been happening in Libya, Syria, et cetera, would never have happened.
Exactly. Senator Bob Graham said that ISIS as we know it today would not exist. And so you're like, what? Senator Bob Graham, this is like, you can't get much more mainstream than that. But this is a guy who's been he was a Florida senator. He was asking the right questions early on. He was angry that Bush censored these 28 pages. I mean, and I'm not a Trump supporter, but even Donald Trump made kind of an oblique reference to this. And I wish he had named the 28 pages specifically. I wish he had a little bit more intellectual rigor about this and had said, but.
Well, like his candidacy, the fact that he felt compelled to bring it out means that, there's a substantial part of the disaffected voting population that is aware of it and feels likewise.
Exactly. And he knew he had to dispatch Jeb Bush because Jeb Bush was, so powerful and so connected and had so much money and just didn't have any kind of charisma or good politics.
Right.
But I enjoyed watching Trump destroy Jeb Bush, and he used 9/11 several times in the past 6 months to do it.
Right. Yeah. Trump and Sanders both are sort of sitting on top of this huge wave of public discontent that's almost inchoate. It's, you can't really call them movements. They're more like a pair of blobs almost. They're so amorphous. But the anger and discontent is deep and structural.
Exactly. And just because Occupy Wall Street is no longer in the headlines, that same energy is still there.
That's right. As a matter of fact, a lot of people from Occupy Wall Street have moved into Sanders' campaign and some into Trump's as well.
Oh, absolutely. I don't doubt it for a second, but probably mostly into Sanders' campaign. I see it a lot. In fact, everybody I run into in New York City is a Sanders supporter. And I think actually you know, the part of my message has got to be to the people, the Democratic establishment who are backing Hillary. I cannot see why you would back Hillary. I can't see what she's done, and I can see her political vulnerabilities. Did you know, Don, even in the Ken Starr report, there was some sort of legal loophole where the people that were trying to get the truth out about witness intimidation in the Vince Foster investigation, they actually got this attachment to the Ken Starr report that talked about Patrick Knowlton, and he was there when the body of Vince Foster was dumped. This was early in the Clinton presidency. They switched, they fired the director of the FBI on the same day that, that Hillary's alleged lover, the White House counsel, Vincent Foster, was found dead across the river in a Arlington Park. Right. And he was found dead of an alleged suicide, but they didn't find the body with a gun. And they didn't find that he allegedly drove himself there, but they didn't find the body with any car keys. And it's just super creepy. And Vince Foster goes way back to the Arkansas Rose Law Firm with Hillary. And anyway, Hillary's political vulnerabilities are huge. Did you know, Don, Hillary also testified at the Iran-Contra hearings? Did you know that?
I didn't remember that for sure. I don't know if I ever knew it.
Yeah. She was, because of Rose Law Firm, and Rose Law Firm was defending some of the tenants right at the MENA airport. MENA airport, was long rumored to be
transshipment for drugs. Yeah,
connected to cocaine and Honduras, and
right.
It's super creepy. The Clintons are super creepy, and they're connected to this big money. It's the worst side of the Democratic Party establishment. And she, she's got these political connections to Kissinger. The Dr. Strangelove. The basis for Dr. Strangelove in in the Kubrick movie of the same name. So
And her daughter, I just saw something go by today. Her daughter is best friends with Trump's daughter.
Be great if Chelsea was a Bernie Sanders supporter.
Hold your breath on that.
Chelsea comes out, I'm with Bernie. Feel the burn.
Okay. All right. So let's go back to the event. Give us a plug.
Okay, great. Well, March 15th, everybody has to come out. It's going to be a great event. It's Jeffrey Lewis, one of the most brilliant, humorous, politically savvy singer-songwriters, with David Rovics, who's one of the more eloquent, passionate, anti-war, pro-peace, historically. He does some great investigative reporting into history through his songs. So those are our two headliners. My band, White Collar Crime, is playing, and we're not too shabby. And then there's Mobile Steam Unit. It was a great art rock band. Everybody's favorite poet, Sparrow, will be reading. And if that, as if that wasn't enough, Don, we have Deanne Killian on her hammer dulcimer. She's kind of like this Lucinda Williams. She's actually great because she's done a lot of work with Brooklyn NVC, Nonviolent Communication, Compassionate Communication. And is really trying to heal the world in her own way, and also uses music to do it.
Yeah, I like that.
Quick plug, March 15th, right. 7 p.m. start time, pianos. It's on Ludlow Street, just south of Stanton, in the good old Lower East Side of New York, New York.
And the name of it is? The name of the venue?
Pianos, the old piano store. Pianos. Gotcha. So please, people, buy tickets in advance. This show will sell out. We have a huge bill. Most of the acts can draw half of the audience by themselves. So
help us fill it up. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So where can I find that? Where can we find tickets on the internet?
Pianos. Just Google pianos, and there's a link to the tickets buying capacity on the pianos website. So just like it sounds, Google pianos, Ludlow Street. Our event is March 15th, Tuesday night. We've got some great co-sponsors. We're looking at Code Pink, maybe Brooklyn for Peace. We're talking to a whole bunch of people. Oh, HR14.org is going to co-sponsor it for sure. Talking to a whole bunch of progressive groups. So again, get tickets in advance, people. The show is going to be like Woodstock 3.
And this is for the benefit of MSF, Doctors Without Borders. And we'd like to thank you, Sandra Hicks. A pleasure as always.
Ron, it's been great being back on your show. Let's do it again.
Yes, sir. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
We'll be right back.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Adam Gitlin, counsel with the Brennan Center for Justice Democracy Program, who discusses the impact new voter suppression laws in 17 states could have on the 2016 presidential and congressional election. Mohammed Hafez, a Syrian-born architect, who explains how he expresses his anguish about the bloody conflict that has engulfed his country through art. And independent journalist Jesse Meyerson, who assesses the discussions now underway to transform Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign into an enduring progressive movement. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In early March, Honduran indigenous environmental activist Berta Cáceres was assassinated by a masked man who broke into her home. 2 weeks later, her colleague, Nelson García, was killed, putting pressure on the Obama White House to pursue justice for dozens of murdered activists, journalists, and labor leaders in Honduras since a 2009 coup. Four men linked to Cáceres' murder were arrested by Honduran police on May the 2nd, but Cáceres' family members have asked for an independent investigation by the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, a demand rejected by the government. The Obama administration supports Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez, even as some U.S. officials suspect state or state-supported assassins killed the activists. The administration's plan to expand an aid package of $750 million to Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala has run into resistance in Congress. 60 lawmakers have signed a letter calling for a partial suspension of aid to Honduras, pending a review of Cáceres' killing and an independent investigation stating, "We are appalled by our government's continuous assistance to the Honduras security services, so widely documented as corrupt and dangerous." Activists see the case as a litmus test for how the Obama administration treats human rights in Honduras. The New River, China's last wild river, winds through a remote area of southwestern China near the border with Myanmar. It is now the scene of a fierce battle between a state-owned electric company and environmentalists. For the time being, it appears green activists are winning the day, as many in China see the area as a future magnet for tourism. In 2013, the Chinese government authorized a state-owned hydropower company to draw up plans for a series of dams on the New River, one of the poorest areas in the country. Yet the power company had not filed any environmental impact statements as required by law in an area designated by UNESCO as a World Heritage Site. Hu Chaogang, head of the group Green Watershed, told the Christian Science Monitor, "The dam proposal will destroy the river ecology and harm local farmers and fishermen." Opponents of the dam project, which would displace some 17,000 indigenous ethnic minorities, are somewhat optimistic, given that there's now less demand for electricity, and the government has been more sensitive to environmental issues with recent efforts to curb air pollution and carbon emissions. In high school, Baltimore resident Destiny Watford raised local concern about the health impact of a proposed massive waste-to-energy incinerator slated for her Curtis Bay neighborhood. The plant would have emitted over 1,000 pounds of lead into the air annually. Watford co-founded the activist group Free Your Voice, which organized opponents to attend public meetings and pressured Baltimore public schools and other institutions to drop their support for the incinerator project, despite strong backing from former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley. In April, Watford won the prestigious Goldman Prize for her grassroots environmental activism, the third youngest person to ever receive the international award. According to a 2013 MIT study, Baltimore has the highest rate of emissions-related deaths of any big city in the United States. Many of the deaths were in Watford's Baltimore neighborhood of Curtis Bay, which is home to the nation's largest medical waste incinerator. In March, the Maryland Department of the Environment pulled the permit. Now Watford and other activists are pushing to develop alternative projects for the site, such as a solar farm or a recycling facility. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
Since the 2010 midterm election, 22 states, most of them controlled by the Republican Party, have passed an assortment of new laws that make it more difficult for specific groups of citizens to vote. 17 states will have new voting restriction laws in place for the first time in a presidential election in November 2016. These measures include restrictive voter ID laws, reduction in the days and hours of early voting, and obstacles placed on registering new voters and accessing absentee ballots. New voter suppression laws in these states were made possible in large part by the Supreme Court's 2013 ruling, which gutted a key section of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. While GOP lawmakers assert new limits on voting rights have been introduced to prevent voter fraud, independent analysis has found no evidence to support their claim. A recent study conducted by the University of California at San Diego on the effect new restrictive voter IDs have had on voting patterns found that these new measures disproportionately affect minority voters that largely support Democratic Party candidates. In fact, accusations by civil liberties groups and other political observers that the new voting restrictions are motivated by the pursuit of partisan political advantage have been confirmed by some Republican Party officials themselves. Todd Albaugh resigned as chief of staff to a leading Wisconsin Republican state senator when he found that new voter ID laws in his state were put in place to reduce the votes of minorities and college students. Former South Carolina senator and current president of the Conservative Heritage Foundation recently admitted that new voter restrictions help conservative candidates by blocking Democratic voters. Your reporter spoke with Adam Gitlin, counsel with the Brennan Center for Justice Democracy Program, who discusses the impact new voter suppression laws in 17 states could have on the 2016 presidential and congressional election.
There are two kinds of restrictions we are seeing, one could say. There are restrictions that have to do with imposing new requirements on voters, like photo ID laws. These are laws that require voters to, even if they're already registered, to show a certain form of ID or one of a few forms of ID before being permitted to vote. And in some states, like Texas, they have restricted heavily the range of IDs that one can show, often without necessarily one seeing a clear connection between the different kinds of ID that one is allowed to show. So, for instance, in Texas, you can use a license to bear a firearm, but you can't use a student ID. And so some of these restrictions seem targeted at trying to make it harder for certain populations to vote, but not others. And then there are the other kinds of restrictions that are rollbacks of earlier expansions of the right to vote, like reducing the number of early voting days, that is, days before Election Day in which you can cast a ballot, eliminating same-day registration, so eliminating the ability to register and cast a ballot on the same day, and other similar expansions of the right to vote that have been rolled back since the Shelby County decision.
There's a lot of concern about the impact of these new voting restrictions on the numbers of people who can vote on Election Day, and also the disproportionate impact, particularly on minorities, young voters, and low-income voters. Review for our listeners a bit about what we do know in terms of the research when it comes to the impact on individual voters and the larger issue of the potential changing of outcomes of victors and losers in elections.
It's important to note at the outset that it's going to take years to fully quantify the impact of voter ID laws, but there is growing evidence of damage. There are studies that have shown a decrease in turnout. Probably the most well-known of these is the nonpartisan U.S. Government Accountability Office released a study that found that turnout among eligible and registered voters declined on the order of 2 to 3% in 2012 in Kansas and Tennessee, both of which have a photo ID requirement. There's a more recent study from some folks at the University of California in San Diego that looked at the minority white turnout gap in strict photo ID law states and states that didn't have strict photo ID laws, and they also found drops in turnout for certain minority groups in states that had stricter photo ID laws. Certainly, there has been some research done on the fact that in oftentimes some of the most politically competitive states, it may be more possible with the right tide to pass a voter ID law because there is some belief that voters of certain political persuasions may be the ones more likely to be affected by these voter ID laws.
Adam, if you could briefly speak to the status of challenges, court challenges, federal court challenges, Supreme Court challenges to some of these laws. Have they been all exhausted here, or what's left on the table in terms of voting rights advocates and what they can do to stop some of these laws?
So a number of these laws are being challenged in a variety of settings. I would say some have more of a public image. There's more recognition that they are likely to be addressed eventually by the Supreme Court than others. Some are simply likelier to move than others. I would say probably the two most notable ones are challenges to North Carolina's voter ID law and challenges to Texas's voter ID law. Both of those are still alive. Last week, as you probably know, in North Carolina, a federal district court judge ruled against the plaintiffs there, but the plaintiffs have already appealed. And in Texas, the law has already been stricken down by three federal courts, but now the full Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals is going to be hearing a challenge to the law, and it's anyone's guess what happens after that, but it is reasonably likely that whoever loses will appeal to the United States Supreme Court.
That was Adam Gitlin, counsel with the Brennan Center for Justice Democracy Program. Learn more about the status of challenges to voter suppression laws across the U.S. by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The war in Syria has entered its sixth year, and despite a partial ceasefire in place for a few months that somewhat reduced the daily number of fatalities and injuries, in late April, attacks by both the Assad government and some rebel groups in the city of Aleppo caused the deaths of more than 200 Syrians. The United Nations and humanitarian groups have estimated that more than 300,000 Syrians have been killed in the war thus far, with more than 11 million refugees and internally displaced persons since 2011, more than half of the country's pre-war population. Mohammed Hafez, born in Damascus, Syria, and educated in the U.S., earned his degree in architecture and is now working for an architectural firm in New Haven, Connecticut. In recent years, he has turned to making art, informed by his architect's training, to create images and sounds of Syria both before the war and after the terrible destruction, loss of life, and dislocation caused by the conflict. Hafez has exhibited his work and spoken to audiences about his art and the war across the Northeast U.S. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Hafez about what motivates his art and his hopes for the future of his war-torn country. As an immigrant to the U.S., he declined to discuss the specific military situation in Syria, but did express his views about the need for more assistance to refugees and international humanitarian aid.
I think my architecture career does influence the art career tremendously. That's primarily because I am interested in the human interaction with architecture. I come from Damascus, which is the oldest city, continually inhabited city in the world. And there are layers upon layers upon layers of human trace on architecture when you walk these old Damascus alleyways and roads. And in that sense, we have the ability to write our history, sort of, on the architectural scape. There's this ability for architecture to become a medium to tell a story, right? So I use that in telling stories about my beloved Syria, in hopes that you tell enough to humanize the conflict so that somebody can relate to these personal stories and day-to-day activities. So that's what I focus on by making miniature work that is highly detailed, yet, you know, politically charged.
You said you spent 8 years in the U.S. before being able to return to Syria in 2011, which was the year the war started, but I understand the war had not yet come to the part of Damascus where you were. What was it like for you?
And that was such a breather because I was so homesick and I was so longing to my beautiful city and country that I started walking around cities and recording people's conversations. I would sit in the courtyard of the Umayyad Mosque and record children playing in the courtyard and record different merchants talking and different calls to prayers off of each of the surrounding mosques. And of course, as we know today, this is a moment of peace that is no longer existent. And I stumbled across these recordings by mistake 4 years later, when I was starting to make political artwork. So these stories are merely, you know, I infuse these sound recordings into these realistic models that reconstruct the destruction of Syria, so to speak. And when you add the sound and the life that was there before the war to the pieces, sort of really adds a fourth dimension to the piece, a consciousness. My goal is to document the normal day-to-day activities. People look at me crazy, like, what are you doing? But I went around and recorded normal conversations, recorded my friends playing cards together at a cafe shop, and, you know, yelling at each other and having a good time, not knowing that 5 years later that each one of them would be living in a different country. Some of them have become residents of other countries in the Gulf region, and some of them have actually become refugees.
Mohammed Hafez, what can you say about the forces fighting in Syria with support from both Russia and the U.S.?
Well, I'm not so sure that there is a distinct Syrian hand anymore. It is so many foreign hands in this kitchen. And I'm not interested in the dirty political game. We're so desensitized to what needs to be done. And when it comes to nations that are meaningfully prepared to stop such atrocities, we don't see much being done.
Would you like to see the U.S. do more in Syria and accept more refugees here?
Yes, of course. Absolutely. This great nation is a defender of liberties and human rights with a decades-long record. I am surprised with the little that has been done to aid the humanitarian efforts in Syria. I don't think there's a household in Syria that hasn't lost somebody, that hasn't paid for somebody in prison, or has somebody as a refugee somewhere. I have an immediate family member as a refugee, and that what drove me to do more and more and more work. The more negative sentiment that I hear on the media against refugees, the more I take it upon myself to educate people around me about who refugees are and what is so devastating on the ground there that is, you know, pressuring a father to put his two-year-old in a float across the Mediterranean.
That was Syrian-born artist and architect Mohammed Hafez. Learn more about his art and views on his country's bloody civil war by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. With the current delegate count favoring Hillary Clinton to win the Democratic Party nomination, many disappointed supporters of Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign are now focusing on a larger goal. Activists who have dedicated the last year to winning primary elections for the Vermont senator are now discussing the potential of transforming their unexpectedly strong campaign into an enduring progressive movement. There are different ideas being floated, but most involve gathering the coalition of left activists that supported Sanders and harnessing the power of the campaign's massive donor network and grassroots organizing operation to promote a progressive agenda at the local and national level. An important meeting is now being planned for late June, after the last primary, and before the Democratic National Convention in July. That meeting, dubbed a National People's Assembly, will take place in Chicago and will draw leaders from the National Nurses United Union, People for Bernie, and groups fighting for a $15 minimum wage, the climate change movement, labor unions, and Black Lives Matter organizations. While Senator Sanders has not directly endorsed the idea of forming a new post-election organization, his wife Jane has affirmed that whether her husband wins or loses the nomination, she says the most important thing is starting a political revolution. Your reporter spoke with independent journalist and co-host of the Disorderly Conduct podcast, Jesse Meyerson, who assesses the effort now underway to transform Bernie Sanders' campaign into a lasting progressive movement.
The Sanders campaign is the one political campaign that actually has anything like a coherent theory of change. In every stump speech, Sanders says, no president, not Bernie Sanders or anyone else, can possibly achieve things like single payer without a political revolution, which is to say without millions of people coming together and having sustained prolonged agitation for these things. But it takes a movement that we're up actually against an extremely popular financial and political and media elite who have to be overcome if we're going to get things like free college, universal health care, guaranteed dignified conditions for all people. And to that end, the hashtag, I mean, the famous hashtag is Feel the Burn, but the hashtag that's used by Sanders supporters more frequently is not him, us, or not me, us, which is in such stark contrast to the Clinton hashtag, I'm with her. I'm with her really makes it about the candidates. Not him, not me, us really makes it about the movement. And so I think from the beginning, the Sanders campaign has actively fostered the idea that it's not so much about the victory of Bernie Sanders. It's about the movement, the political revolution, as he calls it, to great derision from the establishment press. So I think that's kind of baked into it. And actually, I don't think that the problem is specific to if he loses the nomination. I think the problem would remain even if he became the president. I think it would actually only intensify the necessity for sustained, ongoing radical organizing for these things and pressure put on the political system to achieve these things. So I think that's on the minds of a lot of people. Definitely a lot of supporters are having similar kinds of conversations, what to do beyond Bernie, what the political revolution would look like absent the candidate. And I know that there are meetings happening all over the place. I co-hosted a meeting in Brooklyn at a place called Mayday Space about this question and what people are hoping to achieve afterwards. And it seems like people are definitely in, although not analytically, the same place about what exactly would be the right thing to do. I think that at least attitudinally, everyone understands that this isn't a movement that ends here, that actually it has to continue. And that gives me a great deal of hope.
Jesse, a lot of people have been drawn to Bernie Sanders' campaign for a diversity of reasons. But if this campaign were to be transformed into something more permanent, and as far as the progressive movement goes, what do you think the common denominator would be that would draw these people into a longer-term involvement?
That's a wonderful question. I wish I had a really good answer for it. I mean, the sort of scene that I'm more embedded in rather than in the sort of electoral sphere is in the social movement sphere. So the activists who I really talk to and have been trying to build with over the last few years are from the movement for Black Lives, the climate justice movement, the low-wage workers movement, Occupy, the immigration rights movement, Dreamers, and so forth. If we're going to take these social movements and maximize their political efficacy, what is that kind of minimum source of alignment that we would need to have in order to do it? And it's very difficult because the sort of systematic destruction of the left in the United States and our institutions and our political education, so that in a sense we have to kind of rebuild and relearn knowledge that we've lost over these many years of sort of Thatcherite, Reaganite, there is no alternativism. And so the question for me about the Sanders campaign isn't how it itself can be sustained, but what pieces of movement infrastructure will emerge from it, for instance, the fundraising tools, the phone banking tools, all of the various innovations that the campaign has brought to the electoral sphere, how those will survive and how they will interact with the movement infrastructure that's been built by previous movement moments. And I just think that each time we have a movement moment, we land on higher ground, and eventually, ideally, the ground will be so high that we'll have, you know, not to be too ambitious about it, but, you know, captured political power and implemented a program that is in the interest, in the universal general interest, and not in the interest just of the ownership class.
I've been reading about a summit meeting that's going to be scheduled sometime after the last Democratic Party primary to determine what the future might be for the Sanders campaign, whether he wins the nomination or not. Is your feeling that this is where the action is, this kind of summit meeting, or is this just part of a whole host of organizing that's going on around the country, a lot of it below the radar?
Yeah, I think both things are true. I think that that's going to be a very useful place to bring people together and to discuss what's going on. I noticed that recently they put out a call for proposals for speeches and panels and whatnot. But as you say, it's not the action, it's one action. And there are many other places where the Sanders message and the people who've been brought together by the Sanders campaign can conspire for, you know, a much more like locally tailored, you know, responsive to immediate circumstance kind of mode that can let, as they say, 1,000 flowers bloom. So that we're not fixated on a single strategy, but that we're nimble enough that we can find different strategies to approach different issues and yet be united by a common set of values or principles or an ethos.
That was independent journalist and co-host of the Disorderly Conduct podcast, Jesse Meyerson. Find a link to Meyerson's recent article titled Building a Movement from Occupy Wall Street to Bernie Sanders and related information by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Victor Reese, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Afeni Shakur, 1947-2016. She was born Alice Faye Williams in the dusty town of Lumberton, North Carolina, January 10, 1947. A dimpled little black girl who grew into a petite young revolutionary known as Afeni Shakur, mother of a young rap icon and actor, Tupac Shakur. Like many country people, and for too many black people, she looked down at herself for years as not smart enough, not pretty enough, you know, too black. When she joined the Black Panther Party in New York circa 1966, she still had a lot of those attitudes. But the black revolution, at least for a time, changed some of those views. She rarely knew the effect she had on others, for when she entered a room, one felt the urge to rise. She seemed to wonder, who were they rising for? Safia Bukhari, the late Black Panther and Black Liberation Army soldier, wrote in her book, The War Before, of Afeni, an elfin, dark-skinned woman with a very short afro. Afeni Shakur exemplified the strength and dignity amid chaos that I needed to see. She walked with the grace that Safia saw as regality. She was far more than Tupac's mom, but even he recognized her specialness as seen in his classic piece, Dear Mama. She was, in Tupac's words, a black queen. She had her demons, as do we all, drugs, poverty, homelessness. But despite her poverty of riches, she raised a bold black prince, Tupac Amaru Shakur, who in his brief life spit fire and rage and gained the ear of millions. Afeni Shakur, after 69 springs, returns to the infinite. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. MLK versus Obama. On his latest trek to Britain, U.S. President Barack Hussein Obama took a slap at the youthful activists of the Black Lives Matter movement. They were really effective at bringing attention to serious issues, he said, but they failed by not sitting down with political leaders. You can't just keep yelling at them, he chided. Obama's chastisement of the movement then portrayed them as immature, unsophisticated, and unknowledgeable about the mysterious ways of politics, which, in his view, was about sitting down and making deals. This is more than ironic, coming from a president who hasn't been able to meet with a plethora of politicians who oppose him. Guess who else was criticized because he organized protests? Yes. Dr. Martin Luther King, who in his book, Why We Can't Wait, wrote, "We know through painful experience that freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed. Frankly, I have yet to engage in a direct action campaign
that was well-timed in the view of those who have not suffered unduly from the disease of segregation. For years now, I have heard the word wait. It rings in the ear of every Negro with piercing familiarity. This wait has almost always meant never. We must come to see, with one of our distinguished jurists, that justice too long delayed is justice denied. These words from his 1963 letter from a Birmingham jail go on to describe hate-filled policemen, again, King's words, who, he writes, curse, kick, and even kill your black brothers and sisters. It is that continuing crisis that gave birth to Black Lives Matter, not their political naivete. By the way, Black Lives Matter have done far more than yell at politicians. Their efforts led to the electoral defeat of at least two prosecutors who spit on the community and the aftermath of the police killings of Laquan McDonald in Obama's hometown, Chicago, and in Ferguson, Missouri. They have raised the flag of black resistance to injustice. Should they have sat down and quietly discussed matters with Obama's homie, Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel? Emanuel, whose contempt for black life is legendary? Who helped cover up McDonald's murder by police? Yeah, good luck with that. Black Lives Matter's yelling ain't the problem. Far too often, the problem is politicians who make deals why black people die. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Revolutionary. He was not to my liking when he first burst on the scene. He was, quite frankly, too pretty, but Prince was not to be denied. According to one article, he was a youth when he saw the mighty James Brown. The rest is history. He was the son of two musicians. Dad played piano and Mom sang. Music was seeded in his soul. When he took the stage, he gave voice to brilliance, bitterness, love, and loss. He was more than a musician. He was an artist. He painted the world around him in sound. And in order to extend the illusion, he wore heels to create the illusion that he was taller than his 5'2" and self. In truth, he was. He was Prince. And Prince was an absolute genius. He played numerous instruments. He sang. He wrote music. He wrote for other musicians. He led an impressive band, three, in fact. He played jazz, R&B, soul, and anything he wanted to do. He was amazing in many ways and respects. His songs became the music of millions. When he challenged the corporates who owned not just his music, but his name, he identified with an unpronounceable symbol and came out triumphant. He was an African-American original who lived numerous lives in his 57 years of life. When he died, he died alone, yes, but by then he had entered the lives and consciousness of millions and will live still in music that speaks of the deep hidden yearnings of the heart. He sang, "My name is Prince," and the world heard his song. He became more than an ancestor. He became an immortal. From Imprisoned Nation, This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
The left and alternative media being controlled? Why are some of the most prominent independent media organs ignoring inquiry into 9/11, among other topics? Who are behind the major tax-free foundations, and why are they donating to independent media and resistance groups like Occupy Wall Street? What role did foundations play in the genesis of the populist uprisings against Yugoslavian President Slobodan Milosevic, colored revolutions, and the World Social Forum? What are the telltale signs of an authentic versus a co-opted movement? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we continue our discussion of the possibility of revolution against oppressive forces within our society by examining the well-documented efforts by elite foundations like the Rockefeller Foundation and the Ford Foundation to control social movements, ironically, by funding them. We'll hear from Toronto-based media critic Barry Zwicker about foundation funding on alternative journalism. And then we'll hear from Michelle Chalcedovsky of the Center for Research on Globalization on foundation funding impacts on the populist movements they finance. On this week's program, Manufacturing Dissent, When Revolutions Are Sponsored by Wall Street. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of May 6th, 2016. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. When does a civil war become an invasion? The fiction of a civil war and opposition forces, quote-unquote, can no longer be sustained when a large number of those forces are U.S. and allied troops operating within Syria. So far, officially, it's a counter-terrorism operation, quote-unquote, but there are no terrorists to fight because they've been defeated by SAA forces, hence the new influx of terrorists. The strategy now appears to be evolving towards U.S.-NATO boots-on-the-ground, a war theater with the deployment of special forces and eventually regular ground troops in larger numbers, with the danger that Western forces could enter into direct confrontation with Russian as well as Iranian forces and military advisors. That comes from the article, Syria, Escalation, Terrorism, and Military Invasion, a Proxy War Against Russia and Iran, by Professor Michelle Chalcedovsky, posted May 4th. Syrian Information Minister Omran al-Zubi informed on Tuesday that thousands of terrorists have crossed the border into his country in the last few days. Late in April, Syrian Prime Minister Wael Nader al-Halki also warned that more than 5,000 fresh militants crossed the border into the northwestern provinces of Aleppo and Idlib from Turkey, stressing that the ceasefire agreement was being violated by certain parties. As terrorist groups continue to target residential areas in Aleppo City, al-Zubi stressed that Turkey and Saudi Arabia are responsible for the bloody acts of Takfiri militants against innocent civilians. Turkish and Saudi commanders have issued the order for targeting Syrian civilians and army troops in Aleppo, the Syrian information minister said. Al-Zubi also criticized the international bodies and countries for keeping mum about the crimes of the Takfiri terrorists in Aleppo, calling it as, quote, suspicious and questionable, unquote. That comes from the article, supported by U.S. NATO, thousands of Al-Qaeda terrorists arrive in Syria, posted May 4th, originally appearing at Fars News Agency. India used to be universally acclaimed for being a multipolar pillar in the emerging world order. Historically, as one of the founder members of the non-aligned movement, India has been respected for its wise pragmatism and its ability to engage any partner on a win-win basis. India now looks ready to abandon its geopolitical traditions. It seems to be starting a new foreign policy trajectory, openly siding with the U.S. against China in the new Cold War. Prime Minister Modi has made a series of moves over the past month which show that India's strategic calculations have radically changed since U.S. Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter visited the subcontinent last month. That comes from the article, Is India Now a U.S. Ally? Aligned Against Russia and China? By Andrew Korybko, posted May 5th, originally appearing at The Duran. On April 21st, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu flew to Moscow for closed-door talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin. The media reported that the talks were over the situation in Syria, a theme where Moscow has made certain a regular hotline dialogue exists to avoid potential military clashes. According to Russian state media reports, however, in addition, Netanyahu and Putin discussed the potential role of Russia's state-owned Gazprom, the world's largest natural gas producer and marketer, as a possible stakeholder in Israel's Leviathan natural gas field. Russian involvement in the stalled Israeli gas development would reduce financial risk for Israeli offshore gas operations and increase the gas field security, as Russian allies like Hezbollah in Lebanon or Iran would not dare target Russian joint ventures. If the Russian reports are accurate, it could portend a major new step in Putin energy geopolitics in the Middle East, one which could give Washington a major defeat in her increasingly inept moves to control the world's center of oil and gas. That comes from the article, Putin Plays Energy Chess with Netanyahu, by F. William Engdahl, posted May 5th, originally appearing at NEO. On February 2nd, the U.S. Defense Secretary, Russia hater Ashton Carter, announced, and the equally Russia-hating NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg welcomed and endorsed, America's quadrupling of its troops and weapons on and near Russia's northwestern borders, and America's pilot, Dan Barina, is part of this extremely hostile action by the U.S. and NATO against the people in Russia. Russia is now surrounded on and near its borders by numerous U.S. nuclear weapons, weapons and troops that are as close to St. Petersburg and Moscow as they can possibly get without actually invading Russia. In 1991, Mikhail Gorbachev dissolved the USSR and ended its Warsaw Pact upon a promise from the regime of U.S. President George Herbert Walker Bush to the then Soviet, soon to become merely Russian leader, that NATO would move, quote, not one inch to the east, unquote. A promise which the American president told his people in private was actually a lie, but which they and all subsequent U.S. presidents have accepted as a Western policy founded on that lie by expanding NATO not merely one inch to the east, but right up to Russia's very borders. That's what this February 2nd policy by U.S. President Barack Obama and his NATO stooges is bringing substantially closer to culmination. How can this not be provocative? That comes from the article, America's Biggest of All Big Lies, We're Not Threatening Russia, by Eric Zeus, posted May 5th, originally appearing at Strategic Culture Foundation. As the January 1946 report by the U.S. War Department made clear, there was very little discussion of the atomic bombings by Japanese officials leading up to their decision to surrender. This has recently been acknowledged, somewhat stunningly, by the official National Museum of the U.S. Navy in Washington, D.C., which states, quote, the vast destruction wreaked by the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the loss of 135,000 people made little impact on the Japanese military. However, the Soviet invasion of Manchuria changed their minds, unquote. Few Americans realize that six of America's seven five-star admirals and generals who earned their fifth star during the war are on record as saying that the atomic bombs were either militarily unnecessary or morally reprehensible, or both. That was from Peter Kuzinich, speaking with Edu Montesanti in an exclusive interview for Global Research in the article The Untold History of U.S. War Crimes, posted May 5th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. In a previous episode of the Global Research News Hour, we examined the so-called non-profit industrial complex and the idea that supposedly progressive environmental organizations play a role of furthering the goals and ambitions of the planet-demolishing elites they should be fighting. In this episode, we expand that conversation. Michel Chossudovsky will be along shortly to talk about the 1% that have controlled some of the most dynamic popular uprisings in recent history. But first, we explore the all-important role of alternative or left media and how some of the most prominent of these supposedly independent journalistic platforms are enabling rather than confronting the powers that be. Barry Zwicker is a longtime Canadian journalist, broadcaster, and media critic. In recent years, he's become outspoken about his views about 9/11 as being a so-called false flag operation. He is the author of the 2006 book, Towers of Deception, The Media Cover-Up of 9/11. We invite him to our show to discuss the control of supposedly dissident journalism. He's based in Toronto. Good morning, Barry Zwicker.
Hello, Michael. Good to be here.
Thank you for joining us. I guess I wanted to ask you, first of all, because I remember watching a lot of your media commentaries way, way back, and you talked about the manufacture of consent as it applies to mainstream media, and the idea there is that advertising very much shapes what we see in the mainstream media. When would you say you first encountered this idea of controlled media or gatekeepers or whatever you want to call it, this idea that the so-called alternative media or the alternative press are themselves being controlled?
Well, I must admit, I was a bit slow to arrive at the understandings that I now have, and many people do, about the fact, I would say fact, that much, in fact most, of so-called alternative media are manipulated and functioning as a controlled opposition. And I would think that back in the late 70s, if we could go back that far, there were lots of wonderful alternative magazines. There was the St. Louis Journalism Review. There was the Washington Journalism Review. There was the Chicago Journalism Review. There was Ramparts. Those are U.S. There was Guerrilla Magazine here in Toronto. There was just a flowering of these truly, alternative magazines, especially at that time, periodicals, that dared to question all the shibboleths of the society. Well, they died. You know, they all died. That's what happened. And then other developments came along, and I didn't realize until belatedly about the amount of money control that was exerted on the left by major foundations, such as the Ford Foundation and the Soros and the MacArthur in the States, not so much in Canada, the Rockefeller and the Carnegie. And in turn, these foundations had and have close ties with the CIA, you know, the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations, and, my God, the Carlyle Group, that horrible company that profits obscenely from armaments manufacturing. So then, kindly mentioned that in my book, Towers of Deception, in the title, The Shame of Noam Chomsky and the Gatekeepers of the Left, I was lucky to be able to interview a few people, including Bob Feldman, who looked deeply into how this gatekeeping happens. And there is a chart on page 223 of Towers of Deception that just lays it all out. It's rather shocking. Now, subsequently, things have become much more sophisticated. But before I maybe address that, there's something that has been a continuing reality or truth or test since 9/11. This pivotal false flag operation in history, and that is that the gold standard, the litmus test as to whether any media outlet anywhere in the world, on any platform, including social media, the test of whether it's controlled ultimately by the elites is how it deals with 9/11, or 9/11 truth, if you will. And so we can look at this small number of outlets. Now, Global Research is brilliantly at the forefront there. All power to Michelle. And then there's Truth and Shadows out of Montreal that I'm proud to contribute to. And you know what came in on my browser here in my email inbox probably 7 minutes ago is another report from Brass Check TV, which I think operates out of San Francisco. And they deliver to the subscribers videos. The videos can be 2 minutes to 2 hours or more. And the one that just came in as the Brass Check TV report is the entire country is now run based on the 9/11 quote story unquote. Wars are fought, trillions are spent, stolen, and liberties are stripped. It's the lie that destroyed a democracy. So you know that there's Brass Check TV that proudly can take its place among the 9/11 truth media. Mm. So
Barry, if you don't mind my interrupting there, what do you suppose it is about 9/11 specifically? Because, I mean, you hear a lot of these different media outlets on the alternative media, left media, whatever you want to call them, they do critique the invasion of Iraq, for example, or the invasion of Afghanistan. And, you know, what is it about 9/11 that distinguishes it from more conventional forms of dissent?
Well, what distinguishes it is that we have to look at this from the point of view of the elites who want to control the whole dialogue, the dialogue on the right and the dialogue on the left, perfect, so that nobody thinks that there's anything else than right and left. And if the left does not deal with fundamental issues such as false flag operations that start almost all wars and cause such immense grief and destruction. So if the left does not deal with that phenomenon of false flag operations, then, of course, it's really doing the work of the right, because we have to stop this military-industrial complex and the false flag operations that they require in order to fool people into supporting these wars. So that's why it remains a test. Now, the other things, like the invasion of Iraq and so on, no problem. I mean, actually, the perfect template is Noam Chomsky himself. You know, he's written books and books criticizing the American empire in Guatemala, in Nicaragua, everywhere. And yet, he will not touch 9/11. He will not touch JFK's execution by state agents. So, he you know, in other words, that what Noam Chomsky does, the shame of him, if you spread it out over any number of media you care to mention, if they won't go in and touch those third rails that are so hot, that are so central, that we've got to deal with if we hope to save the world, then you know you've got your control one way or another. Now I say the ultimate control, because a lot of people don't know they're being controlled. You know, there are people in the alternative media who maybe get some funding from some nice-sounding organization and left-sounding organization, and then they don't look further, and it turns out that organization, in turn, is getting money indirectly from the Ford Foundation or those people at the top, and it ultimately goes right back up absolutely to the top.
Could you tell me how what would work at the journalist, like the level of the journalist? Because I imagine a lot of these people who go into alternative media, they are instinctively, you know, dissenters and critical of power. So I'm wondering how does it work? I think some people may think simplistically that, you know, somebody's got a gun to Amy Goodman's head or whatever, and so she's forced to. Like, how is it that, say, you know, whether it's her or anyone else who's not really very vocal about 9/11 and these other inconvenient issues, how is that apparatus operating to control the product?
Well, you might look first at the people who enter journalism, the people who apply for jobs as reporters, and they're tending to become then foreign correspondents and editors, and ultimately maybe they largely inevitably become careerists to some extent or another. Almost anybody who joins any organization does want to rise, and so they enter. Now they are already. These people, and I know I taught journalism at Ryerson for 7 years. I went through all this myself on all sorts of levels, in radio and television and magazines and in journalism education. They are not a bunch of these fresh-eyed students who come in, freshmen into journalism schools. They are not particularly radical. And maybe at one time they were, but they're products of the culture. And they're also products of the brainwashing of the culture. So when they come into journalism school, they're not particularly tuned to 9/11. And then when they get a job, if they somehow run into some horrible radical like Michael Welch or something who opens their eyes a little bit, what do they do? Well, Michael Prenti put it well in his book, I think, Inventing Reality, or one of his books. He said a reporter maybe gets an important idea about a difficult subject and goes to an editor and says, I think I'd like to write about this. And the editor says, well, I don't think so, not today. And then that reporter perseveres, and later he goes and he says, I have this other idea I'd like to write about. And then the editor says, no, you know, that's not in our mandate, and so on. And as Prenti says, the third time, the reporter doesn't even go and ask the editor. And that is the subtle psychological way that it works.
How has this system evolved in the last 20, 30 years?
Well, it's become, first of all, more sophisticated. I mean, I think that's the main thing. And the culture, I mean, on Truth and Shadows, I wrote about, you know, this vast illusion we live within, where so much of what we believe just isn't so. And these various fictional stories are knit together in a vast tapestry of the illusion. And 9/11 would be an example. The Boston Marathon would be an example. The Charlie Hebdo would be, on and on it goes with false flag ops. But it also goes on with cultural institutions. And, you know, I'm, for instance, if I just have time to mention, in Canada, we have an elite. We've always had an elite, you know, with Wallace Clement writing and John Porter way back in the 70s writing about the Canadian elite, and then Peter Newman writing the Canadian establishment and so on. Absolutely an elite right from the foundation of this country, and it continues on. So one of the elites now is Peter Munk. And Peter Munk throws his money around in very smart ways in his Barrick Gold Enterprise. Now, Professor Anthony Hall has written brilliantly about this in Common Ground and elsewhere. Should really look at. He just digs into the history of Peter Munk and Barrick Gold, which have deep connections to the Bush family and so on, just as an example. And so the Munk Center at the University of Toronto named after Peter Munk, and so that center sponsored one of the most important debates of the past federal election campaign. You know, it took place in Roy Thompson Hall, itself named after a capitalist media entrepreneur who did nothing to elevate the state of journalism in Canada his whole life. And I worked for Thompson, right, in the Sudbury Star. So I happened to go down to Roy Thompson Hall before the debate to offer those who were lined up to enter the latest copy of Common Ground. And that cover featured a picture of Brigitte Depape, you know, the parliamentary page and the Canadian activist who came to national attention in June 2011 by holding up her Stop Harper sign and now it's comments. Now, there are three or four of us just trying to give free copies of Common Ground to these people lined up. There must have been like 1,500 of them. And I myself, and this was true of the others, only succeeded in getting maybe three people to accept into their hands even to look at that. And the look on those people, they were so sleek, they were so well-dressed, they just had that confident bearing that you expect to see in the elite. And a fellow activist told me, Karen Brothers, she said, I've never seen so many $1,000 pairs of women's shoes in one place in my life before. So the Munk Center more or less manipulated the audience at that leaders' debate about foreign policy at sponsored by the Munk Center and held at Roy Thompson Hall. And the McDonnell Laurier Institute, we don't have to go into, but I attended a meeting on April the 18th here in Toronto. I paid $15 to hear a debate, and it was resolved that the danger of terrorism is grossly exaggerated. Now, on the positive side was none other than Jonathan Cade, and arguing against was Christopher Alexander. You know that Harper guy. He was in the Harper government, And so they only allowed, here's how the manipulation goes, so many ways, so subtly. When the question period came, they only allowed 1 minute for anybody to ask a question. 1 minute. So I was about the second person to ask a question. I asked it, in a quite civil and clear way. And I said, you talked a lot about media coverage of terrorism. You never mentioned false flag operations that are part and parcel of this whole fraudulent terrorist fear campaign. And I said, you must know about these. I said, for instance, Daniel Gansner's book, NATO's Secret Armies. And when I said that, Christopher Alexander actually nodded in the affirmative. In other words, he had read that book. But you know what? They totally dodged my question, and nobody asked anything afterwards. And so there's very subtle ways that they control the public agenda. One place you can't look to for brave speaking out are the traditional left-wing magazines such as, I don't know, Workers, Vanguard, or whatever. I see people handing them out from time to time. And, I mean, I've talked to a leading member of the Socialist Caucus about 9/11, and he actually became quite exercised. I said, look, you know, you're not dealing with 9/11 in your publication, which is Socialist Canada or whatever. And he said, no, I'm not. Well, I said, why not? He says, because it's unimportant. It's completely unimportant. He said, it's of minuscule importance. Those were his exact words. I mean, I could hardly believe my ears. I mean, how could a guy, and he's otherwise clever and well-spoken and very much on the left, but I could only take it that he is an agent. You know, he just has to be. He couldn't be that far off base on 9/11 and be legitimate and authentic. I don't think. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think so. And so they plant their people. There's huge numbers of people planted on the left.
When you've got even the so-called alternative media broadcasting the same message as the mainstream media and basically what elites will let you get away with, that's not very promising in terms of being able to start to foment a real revolutionary pressure.
No. I mean, you could become a little bit despairing when you look at the big picture or all the little pieces in the big picture. And you wonder how in the world, will we save the world? Because the existing structure, you know, it was a president, Charles Wilson, former president of General Motors. They called him Engine Charlie Wilson. And in his autobiography, which was My Life with General Motors, there was a line that really struck me. He said, structure is strategy in slow motion. And so that's why it's important to look at how is the Monk Center run? How's the McDonnell Laurier Institute run? How's the Ford Foundation run? You look at the structures of these, and you look at the people who fill all the top posts, and you can see a strategy. And they have a common value system, and their strategy is to defend global monopoly capitalism come what may, to continue to indulge in wars for profit and so on. So I think we have to look at the structures, and also we can look at the individuals who comprise the structures, and then and then look at their policies. But structure comes first, really.
Barry Zwicker, it's great having you on the show.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your calling.
We've been speaking with Barry Zwicker, longtime Canadian journalist, broadcaster, and media critic, and author of the 2006 book Towers of Deception, The Media Cover-Up of 9/11. He joins us from Toronto. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. So the question of elite infiltration of social movements is a phenomenon that anyone wishing to make positive change in this world needs to reconcile. One individual who's written extensively about his concerns of some of the movements within North America and around the world that are being infiltrated or co-opted in some way is Michel Chossudovsky.
Michel Chostadovsky is Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of Ottawa, the founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, and the award-winning author of 11 books, including The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order, America's War on Terrorism, and The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity. He's written extensively on the subject of foundation funding of populist movements, including Occupy Wall Street. He joins us now from his home in Montreal. Good morning, Professor Chostadovsky.
Good morning.
So last week, I interviewed one of the co-founders of Occupy Wall Street, who also happened to be a former editor of Adbusters. And this was on the occasion of the release of his book, The End of Protest. And the interview was centered around the mechanics of protest and resistance and what makes for successful and effective activism. However, you did have some misgivings about the interview, and maybe you'd like to share some aspects that with our listeners that may have concerned you.
I think the fundamental premise of activism against an established economic and political order is ultimately to be totally independent. And the problem which was facing Occupy is that they were funded by Wall Street. Occupy Wall Street is funded by Wall Street. It's a very convenient arrangement. And I'm not suggesting that the people at the grassroots of this organization are not, they're good people, they're activists, they believe in what they're doing. But at somewhere further up in the hierarchy, there are individuals who are tacitly co-opted, and invariably this process of co-optation is the funding arrangement, it's money. And if you look at the structure of foundation funding, you'll see that a large number of these organizations, sometimes very small organizations, are funded by tax-free foundations, charities. It's not something which is necessarily easy to observe, because the funding of grassroots organizations may go through a whole network. In other words, the Ford Foundation, which is linked up to the CIA, we know that. It originally was an offshoot of the CIA. The Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Brothers, the MacArthur Foundation, the major foundations, the Gates Foundation,
the Tide Foundation,
precisely and then the OSI, the outfit of George Soros. All these organizations ultimately fund, directly or indirectly, social movements. The World Social Forum, right from the outset, was funded by the Ford Foundation. And I've been analyzing this right from the outset, also of the World Social Forum, saying you cannot, in a meaningful way, address the issue, address the elites and then ask the elites to fund your activities. In fact, that is what has happened. And I raised it with people at the World Social Forum, and in fact, they dismiss it. They know about it. They say, well, it doesn't really matter who funds our activities. We have a good debate, and we're committed to, unseating Wall Street. But if Wall Street is funding their activities, of course, they go nowhere. And what all this results in is, in fact, piecemeal activism, do-it-yourself, fragmented groups. We can see it at all the people summits, and it becomes a ritual of dissent. And the protagonists, the people who actually fund this, they know about it. Okay, we recall the statement of George Bundy, who was National Security Advisor to JFK, and to Lyndon Johnson, and I quote, "Everything the Ford Foundation did could be regarded as making the world safe for capitalism, reducing social tensions by helping to comfort the afflicted, provide safety valves or they're angry, and improve the functioning of government. Now, essentially, really, what all this is that you provide funding to dedicated people, and what happens is that these people ultimately, when they come to renewing their funding, certain conditions are placed and activism is controlled. And that's what I call manufacturing dissent, as opposed to manufacturing consent, which was the concept coined by Ed Herman and Noam Chomsky, which, of course, is also another process, but it's a different process. And now what we have is a whole series of organizations all over the world, political parties, NGOs, which are funded by powerful financial groups. And I should mention that this funding has become extensive precisely because there's been an enrichment of the elites, and they don't know what to do with their money. So they channel it precisely into areas which protect them. And, you know, Warren Buffett was supporting the Occupy movement. Now, Warren Buffett is one of the wealthiest individuals on planet Earth. And if we want to address issues of social inequality, we can't ask Warren Buffett, can you pay for our travel expenses? So that is what is behind this whole process.
So,
it's the funding of dissent, but it's the funding of dissent by the people which are the object of dissent.
So if you want to, the best way to fight a nascent populist movement is to take it over, and that's how they do it, by financing them.
Well, precisely. We've got a lot of examples of that. It's not limited to Occupy. We saw it emerging, let's say, in Yugoslavia, where we had this organization called OTPOR. And OTPOR is the organization which has the symbol of the fist, and that symbol has been used in a number of organizations throughout the world. But OTPOR, that was in the year 2000. It was a sort of a grassroots, or it promoted a grassroots movement. It was an intelligence op. It was linked up to the CIA. That's well documented. But then you had similar processes taking place, let's say, in Egypt during the Arab Spring. You had movements which were directly funded by the United States, by the National Endowment for Democracy. I'm talking about kifaya. Now, kifaya in Arabic means enough. And it just so happens that in other countries, they had the same logo and the same title. So kifaya was a group which had links to the U.S. State Department. They had met up with Hillary Clinton and Condoleezza Rice at different moments prior to the Arab Spring. And then you'd had the April 6th movement, which was supported by the U.S. Embassy. And what is, I think, very distinct as far as the Arab Spring is concerned is that people were being oppressed by neoliberal policies starting in 1991. So in other words, 20 years of strong economic medicine, destroying social programs, cutting budgets, deregulating agriculture. And ultimately what happens is that these people then, of course, they organize and they're infiltrated. And in a bitter irony, the actual architects of Egypt's social crisis, namely the IMF, the World Bank, Wall Street, the European creditors, are simply not the object of any kind of dissent. Okay? They are going after the puppets. They're going after Mubarak. And then there's regime change. So that, in effect, the neoliberal agenda creates the conditions for dissent, so to speak. Okay? People are struggling against neoliberalism, whether it's in Egypt or in Greece, and so on. And then what happens is that ultimately this movement leads to social strife, regime change, and continuity of the neoliberal agenda. And that is really what the elites are seeking. And the strategy is essentially to support both sides.
Professor Chostadovsky, I just want to kind of review some of what you just said there, because in terms of this idea of having this sort of a co-opting of these populist movements, you're not only kind of diffusing these popular sentiments that could threaten an existing order, but you can also manipulate it so that if you have an inconvenient puppet or whatever, you can just use these movements under the guise of responsibility to protect or whatever, so that the real motives behind a regime change or whatever are masked by this illusion of popular, not completely illusory, but you're manipulating populist discontent in order to execute an initiative that's not really servicing the interests of the people, but it's rather you're manipulating, you're taking that energy and directing it in a way that's not really what they were intending.
Well, I think we have a lot of populist movements emerging in Europe. Podemos in Spain, of course, Syriza in Greece. And then what happens very often is that individuals within this movement, and sometimes the leaders or the intellectual architects of this movement, they are co-opted, literally. There's a long history of that, where people, we think we go back to Seattle or to Quebec City, the late 90s, 2001 in Quebec City. These movements ultimately are co-opted through links between the financial elites and individuals within NGOs and social movements, who are then invited to the forums at Davos and so on, so that they mingle. They mingle with the elites. And they believe ultimately that dialogue is the solution, but there's absolutely no evidence that dialogue is going to lead us anywhere.
Mm. So I wanted to bring up an example of what they called the Maple Spring, in the Printemps d'Érable in your home province of Quebec. I don't know, you kind of had like a front row seat to that. That was a massive uprising of thousands of people against what was happening within the educational system in Quebec. Do you have any reservations about that? Do you see any instances of somehow a co-optation of that movement?
I don't see that movement really in the same light as some of the other movements. It was something which was very specific. It was largely motivated by tuition fees and student debt. It did not extend beyond the student movement. I mean, there was solidarity expressed in that regard. But ultimately, what prevailed was the neoliberal agenda, the Parti Québécois said they supported the aspirations of the student movement, but the moment, of course, they came into government, they actually clamped down, and they adopted the policies which were dictated by the state creditors and the financial institutions. So, but that's another level I think it's a different dynamics, because it was not comparable, let's say, to some of the movements which have emerged, let's say, in Europe, which have become really overall grassroots movements. But when you start analyzing them, you realize that they are, in many cases, either infiltrated and/or funded by corporate foundations, and that is how these corporate foundations managed to control the protest movement.
Do you have any insights into maybe call them warning signs? I mean, when you look at a certain group that threatens to or appears on the surface to be threatening the natural order, what should we look for in order to ascertain whether this is a co-opted movement or an authentic one? Is there certain patterns in terms of what they demand?
I think we have to see who is funding them, okay? And you mentioned the case of the Occupy movement. Well, the Occupy movement was funded initially through Adbusters, which is a Vancouver-based organization, NGO, which in turn was supported by a foundation called TIDES, T-I-D-E-S. Now, TIDES is considered to be a sort of progressive foundation because its main mandate is to fund activism. And if you look at their balance sheet, you'll see that they fund lots of groups, sometimes with small grants of $20,000, $40,000, $50,000. They have a very large budget, but TIDES is really a clearinghouse for the key players. In other words, the Rockefeller brothers, the Ford Foundation, MacArthur, and so on. So that what happens is that you have some kind of a network, and it's not always easy to follow where the money goes from, let's say, Rockefeller and Ford to TIDES, and then from TIDES it goes to Adbusters, and then from Adbusters it goes to Occupy, okay? And then you ask people in the Occupy movement, do you know that Wall Street is actually supporting you? And they said, oh, no, we don't know where the money comes from. They don't know where the money comes from. And they think that, and I said, well, listen, because I actually was in New York and I spoke to people in the streets. I said, do you know that your organization is funded by very wealthy people? And there was a sense of ritual and folklore underlying this protest movement. Wall Street wasn't threatened in any way by this bunch of people who didn't ultimately understand. They didn't understand the workings of the financial system to start with. They'd been misled by their leaders, and there was a ritual of dissent. And ultimately, that doesn't threaten anybody within the financial establishment. And what I've always said, if you want to address in a meaningful way the issue of dissent against an established order, you have to ultimately question their legitimacy. Okay, you're not going to send a petition to these people. You're going to question their legitimacy, the fact that the whole state structure in the United States is criminalized, the justice system is criminalized, the financial system is fraudulent. So what do? You try to undo these people, to unseat them, so to speak, because they are involved in an illicit procedure. They're manipulating, they're enriching themselves at the expense of the large majority of the population. And you have to break the consensus. And you don't break the consensus by asking them to fund your operating expenses. So the ultimate rule is that activism, if we want to talk about real activism, it doesn't come from paradigms or you know, ideology. It comes from action which seeks to unseat a particular social, economic, and political order. And you can only do that if you're independent, and you can only do it if you have an understanding of how this system actually operates.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, your global research does not accept foundation funding, so you don't have any pressure to censor anything that you put out or say, and so that gives your website an opportunity to ongoing way question the legitimacy of the overlords.
We don't accept any kind of corporate funding. We get contributions from our readers, and occasionally there are a few cases where people have left money in their will when they passed away, and which was a fabulous gesture to us. And we've managed, but again, our objectives are very modest in terms of we're not an activist organization. We're a media group. But at the same time, I should mention we don't necessarily present an editorial line. We publish very different perspectives. I think ultimately what the guiding principle is honesty in reporting and truth in media. But it doesn't mean, for instance, we have people, well, today we published a statement by Maureen McGuire, who's a Nobel Prize winner, on the role of the Catholic Church as, progressive elements within the Catholic Church. Well, it's a viewpoint. It's not necessarily my viewpoint, but I respect it. And Maureen McGuire is somebody with whom we have had previous contact. So we're not putting forth a sort of niche leftist perspective. We publish varied points of view. But our main thrust is really is ultimately to challenge the New World Order, to challenge these financial elites, not at the level of a paradigm. You don't change the world with a paradigm, but you provide concepts and instruments to the formation of mass movements. But those mass movements can only be effective if they are totally independent. And unfortunately, also what has happened is that the trade union organizations have also been co-opted. Now, the trade union organizations, workers' organizations, they did have the financial capabilities, and they still do up to a point. But what has happened, and it's not recent, and it's part of the neoliberal agenda, is to bring them to Davos, to the World Economic Summit, and then to accept them as guests and civil society leaders within the inner circles of power, and ultimately to co-opt them, co-opt the labor leaders, who are ultimately also. They're responsible to their grassroots, but they are also sometimes they go against their grassroots, and all this is really based on the notion that capitalism as an economic system cannot be challenged. Okay, you can have dialogue in relation to capitalism, give and take, but fundamental. Let's say fundamental changes in the workings of this system are not allowed. Okay, and that is what these activists have been, in fact, doing now. They're involved in dialogue with the establishment rather than leaders of an opposition to the prevailing social and economic system. So that is, I think, what's behind all this. It's a very complex process, but mind you, at this juncture in our history, the conflict is not between capitalism and socialism. There's a geopolitical game going on in different regions of the world. The government of Dilma Rousseff in Brazil is not a socialist government by any means, nor was that of Lula. And in fact, they have a neoliberal perspective. But what the United States doesn't like of these governments is that they are not quite in line with the interests of global capitalism. They are, in other words, they want to, in fact, dictate and choose their leaders. And they're doing that. When they start to destabilize when they start to challenge China or Russia, for that matter, they're not challenging an economic and social system. It's the same social system in China. It's capitalism. Yeah. But it's Chinese capitalism. And I certainly wouldn't build an apology for Chinese capitalism. It's the most oppressive social structure, with very low wages and concentration of wealth. But ultimately, what the United States is seeking is predominance over all forms of economic organization. And in this case, it's these countries are national capitalist societies. Certainly, Brazil, Argentina are capitalist countries. So was Egypt, perhaps with a different perspective, with a reformist perspective. But at this stage in our history, in the post-Cold War era, that is the main thrust, and it's to implement regime change in a sort of neo-colonial perspective in all major regions of the world, and install puppets. And if the government in power has some element of independence, i.e. Bashar al-Assad, they will want to replace him by somebody who is going to obey orders. And of course, in the Middle East, the way to undermine national sovereignty is to install the Islamic State. The Islamic State is a project of U.S. intelligence. It's to support the installation of governments which do not threaten the hegemony of the United States and which can be manipulated.
Professor Chalcedovsky, I'm afraid we have to leave it there, but I do thank you for sharing these insights with us, and I always look forward to talking to you. So thank you very much. Professor Chalcedovsky is Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of Ottawa and the founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.